The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Thursday, April 12th, 2018. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. I am broadcasting live far from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. But instead, I am live from the Lautrec Exhibit Hall at the Wynn Hotel in Las Vegas, Nevada, where the Mass Torts 2018 conference. On the program today, we'll be talking to various folks who are either lawyers or involved in cases that involve corporations, malfeasance. We will be talking about finance and opioids and sexual harassment and more. Meanwhile, the rest of the world moves on. Paul Ryan pretends he wants to spend more time with his teenage sons during the week. And Missouri Governor Greitens accused of sexual assault. Apparently, our CIA buddies in Yemen are torturers. And Trump's federal court picks at being placed on the court at a record-breaking pace, and they're loons. Meanwhile, Trump is waffling on attacking Syria. And Mulvaney claims he hasn't burned the CFPB down to the ground. He's only put it to bed. All right, folks. So we got a lot of news, obviously, you know, in the past. I guess now we've done a couple of these during the Trump era, but the news has been particularly nuts this week. Ranging from Michael Cohen's visits from the FBI to Paul Ryan deciding to step down, and all of us anticipating or wondering whether or not we're about to get involved in a much wider conflict in the Middle East. Let's play this clip, though. Let's start with this, and then we're going to get to we're going to speak to someone that we actually spoke to last time we were here to get updated on Sue the Collector. But here is Jimmy Kimmel talking about Paul Ryan, I guess last night.
Meanwhile, there's a major disturbance in the force today after their dramatic announcement from the Speaker of the House.
Today, I am announcing that this year will be my last one as a member of the House. To be clear, I am not resigning. I intend to full my serve term as I was elected to do.
Did he just say he intends to full his serve term?
I intend to full my serve term as I was elected to do.
Okay. He's going to full his serve term as he was elected to do. Anyway, I'm sorry I interrupted. Go on.
But I will be retiring in January, leaving this majority in good hands with what I believe is a very bright future.
Well, you know what? Say what you want about Paul Ryan. He's got a great sense of humor. Ryan said he wants to spend more time with his children. And by with, he means away from. And by children, he means Donald Trump. So he said he's retiring from Congress with no regrets. His only regret is not taking health care away from more poor people. That will haunt him for some time. But
you got to enjoy that last dig there. But I have to say that the idea that Paul Ryan is not running for president in 2020 or running for vice president in 2020 is just...
Vice president?
It just seems so incredibly obvious to me that this guy is just getting while the getting is good.
Vice president?
He's going to run. He may end up, he's going to run for president. He may end up, but this is what he's doing. He's trying to get away from the Trump stink. And I doubt that he'll even serve out the rest of his term. Although,
so when does he give his first, oh, you know, Trump is so rude speech?
That won't happen until he's out of Congress.
Right.
And it will only happen after everyone else has decided that Trump has lost his value to the Republican Party. He will not be in the vanguard of criticizing Trump whatsoever, in my opinion. Although, I mean, I think it'll come down to, you know, whether or not there are. I don't think you can indict a sitting president, but whether, you know, what happens with the Mueller investigation. That's what he's doing. He's simply leaving now that the getting is good. And it's, I don't know. I watched a little bit of cable news about it, but the idea that people are taking this announcement at face value, his oldest kid is 14 years old. If anyone has a teenager, the idea that he is going home because to spend the weekdays with the teenagers is insane.
You mean logistically, or who the hell would want to spend time with a 14-year-old like that?
No, I mean, what 14-year-old gives a crap that dad's home?
No, of course. I just want to read, I just remembered this quote. I want to read it really quick because maybe this is in the sort of background signals here. Eric Erickson just did a profile with an anonymous far-right Trump voting Trump district congressman where this guy said, among other things, about Trump, it's like Forrest Gump won the presidency, but an evil, really effing stupid Forrest Gump. He can't help himself. He's just an effing idiot, and he thinks he's winning when people are bitching about him. I wish the MF-er would just go away. F him. So I bet Ryan's having those conversations.
Oh, yeah, he may be. But it's not like these people don't continue to enable him.
Well, no. Devin, the guy openly says that he will continue to enable him in the rest of the piece. It's just, right. Totally.
So one of Trump's only virtues is the way he cucks all the establishment Republicans. And I cannot wait to see him spank Paul Ryan every which way.
I think that's true.
I wish there was pictures of that. Oh. All right. We will talk later in the program about what's going on in terms of Syria. I guess this morning Donald Trump tweeted out, maybe I never said I would attack Syria. Maybe I will, maybe I won't. I mean, I don't know if that's his, that's the way that he's going to maintain some element of surprise. I have no idea. But we will get to that in a moment. But right now, Jarrett, bring on to the show Jared Johnson. He is the owner, I guess, right? Owner?
Yes, I'm a co-founder and owner.
Okay. Yes. And Matt, let me know how Jared's sound is. He is the owner and co-founder of SueTheCollector.com.
That's correct.
Jared, we had you on the program, I guess it was last October.
Yes.
And people responded exceptionally well. Walk us through this, and then I want to hear about, you know, anything that's changed since you were...
So Sue the Collector is a consumer-friendly website that helps consumers sue debt collectors whenever debt collectors violate basic federal laws that are written to protect consumers against creditor harassment, telephone harassment, or errors on your credit report, even, for that matter. So... we have attorneys all across the United States that this is what they do. The largest of all the attorneys that do this is Ahmad Suleiman at the Atlas Consumer Law in Chicago, Illinois, and their group has successfully now dispatched over $1 billion in consumer debt thus far. We are a pretty large contributor to their success, and they are doing very well in court. And so we would love to help consumers, try and do it every day. Not everybody has a case, but many do. And so we try to, you know, get that debt canceled, try to get their rights established. And look, the problem, I think, Sam, is the fact that so many consumers don't know their rights. They are fully unaware that there are these consumer rights.
So, all right, so just to be clear here, there are a lot of statutes on the book
that
restrict, and these are federal statutes or they're both state and federal.
And so specific states have their own version of the same, almost mirror copy of the federal statute, but then tweaked a little bit.
In some ways, they may go further than the federal.
Further.
So these statutes are on the book. They constrain debt collectors in certain ways, and basically, debt collectors and other outfits have taken advantage of the fact that most consumers don't have a clue as to what their rights are, and so they just operate in the way they want to operate, the debt collectors, and because they don't anticipate having to pay off or pay for. Now, so, okay, give us an example, because this is not just a situation where you get your debt collected, right? Like, you can actually get damages from the...
You can get significant payouts. There, and we were talking last night at a really awesome cocktail party. There's a case that Mr. Suleiman is now prosecuting in Illinois right now against Ocwen Financial. Ocwen's a mortgage servicing company. This lady could not afford her mortgage payments anymore, so the U.S. Bank was the original creditor on the mortgage. What they do is they sell or transfer the asset over to Ocwen for them to service it. A lady entered a Chapter 13 bankruptcy, so she's now got to make payments to the 13 trustee, and if she does everything she's supposed to do at the end of a period of time, 5 years or whatever, the whatever was behind on her mortgage will now be erased, any fees and so on. Ocwen, the whole time that she was going through the bankruptcy, was tallying additional interest and fees on debts that were discharged. So then by the end of the 13, when she got her debt discharged, they came around and said, "You owe us all this money," trying to collect on debt that was legally discharged inside of a bankruptcy. To speed up the story, I talked to Ahmad's office manager. He said the day one on the trial, Ocwen had a big screen up in the front of the courtroom. Their opening argument said, "Ocwen is sorry." Just a total plea for, like, don't kill us, madam, and people on the jury, because they know they're going to get killed. And so, you know...
Well, talk also... Okay, so...
But how many people is that happening to, is what I'm saying.
Right.
They're going through this Chapter 13, and all this stuff's going on, and even inside of legal bankruptcies, debt collectors continue to try and collect debt they have no right to collect whatsoever.
Talk about in terms of, let's say, and I think a lot of folks who listen to the program have student loans. In those instances, like, where are there opportunities if debt collectors are getting too aggressive or tend to break the law in pursuing debt?
So student loans. Okay, so fun. Here's a fun fact about student loans. And so... if you have a servicing company servicing a federally backed student loan, you can tell the callers that call your phone you don't want them to call anymore. They actually have the legal right to still call your phone because it's a federally backed student loan, but they can only call you a maximum of 3 times a month. So the moment they cross that line, if you say, "Don't call my mobile phone anymore," and they call it 4 times in a month, you have a violation. You can sue them for that. And so there's other little things.
So if somebody's at home right now and they have a debt collector who is calling them, it's the fourth time they've called them this month, what do they do at that point?
They need to answer the phone. We can tell everybody, don't ignore phone calls from debt collectors. Answer the phone. Answer the phone because you want to know who's calling you. A lot of times debt collectors will say, "Hey, we need to verify who you are in order for us to talk to you about the debt." Do that, because you need to at least get to that point where they can actually tell you, "Well, this is why we're calling." And then that way, if they're harassing you or something illegal is going on, you'll be able to then retroactively prove damages that this is what happened. But if you don't answer the call, a lot of
times... Do you have to record the call or something?
No, they record the call. They are obligated by federal law to record all outbound collection calls. If they don't, there's even more penalties for them on that side.
Interesting.
Whether or not they're going to cough it up in a, I can't think of the word right now.
Okay, so if I'm getting called, and even if I don't know my rights in regard to, because I wouldn't know that 3 is okay, but 4 is not.
Right, but that's if you revoke consent.
Okay, so...
So you have to tell the caller, student-backed servicing company, like Acme is a big one, you got to tell them to stop calling. In doing that, you revoke consent to calls on your mobile device. Does not apply to voice over IP phones, landlines. The law doesn't apply to those things.
All right, so there's all these specifics,
there
right?
Is.
Like that, and you know this stuff because you've obviously studied it.
Yes.
Is there a general rule that people should follow in relationship to debt collectors? Should people just, if you are in a situation where you're being contacted by debt collectors in any way, or have issues with your mortgage, or what about, and I want to move on to like sort of more traditional banking institutions, but should they simply just go to sue the collector and there's a resource there to learn their rights? Or is there some type of system of like, hey, I'm getting 5 calls a week, but it's on my landline.
Right.
And is this appropriate? I mean, do people go about doing it?
So there are all these little tripwires for debt collectors to trip over that would then suddenly make something illegal. And there is a little room for them to operate, but the moment that they go too far, then it's suddenly illegal. So what I mean by that is the Telephone Consumer Protection Act was written and designed to preserve your cell phone minutes. That's literally what it's about. Because when debt collectors would call a person with a prepaid mobile phone, if they called them 20 times a day, they would use up all their minutes on their phone. So that's why Congress wrote that rule. It's the weirdest thing. To me, it makes sense, but then now it does a lot more. So that's why it doesn't really apply to landlines, voice over IP, because those typically don't have minutes.
Can they just call you relentlessly on landlines? So there are limitations.
Cannot, because under the FDCPA, there are specific guidelines that says repeatedly calling your phone to harass is a violation of the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. It's not a TCPA on its face, but then it goes back to the FDCPA that does prohibit repeated ongoing harassing phone calls.
All right, so getting back to my original question, what do I do if I have a relationship with a debt collector? What do I do to
Step
see
one,
if I, my my
let me
rights
ask
have been
you,
violated?
Sam, do you think that it is legitimate to try and handle a disputable financial transaction over the phone without anything in front of you? You're just going to take this person's word on the phone that this is what you owe. Does it seem should you do that? Should you give them the money if they just say you owe me $50? Or wouldn't you want to like see something, some proof?
I ask for proof for everything.
Okay,
I mean,
so that's step one. So that's why we tell people to don't really get involved with debt collectors on the phone. Because they are now obligated, have been forever, to send you a letter in the mail. And in fact, they are obligated to send you a letter in the mail within 5 days of the first communication. So they call you, they're now obligated to sending you a letter about the account within 5 days. If you don't get that letter, they've already violated the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act on the G notice. That's what that's called. The G notice will tell you what you owe, what they're calling about, how much the debt is, who the original creditor is, the fact that you have the right to dispute the debt within 30 days, that you have the right to get a transcript of any judgments, and so on. And so that's what we tell people. Dispute the debt if you don't think you really owe it. At the very least, get the documentation that breaks down how much you owe, and that way you can actually see, look, this is, you could, if it's not right, then you can go back and you can actually do what's called a debt validation letter.
The first rule is, if you get a phone call and someone says, I'm calling from so-and-so debt collection, and you owe $500. I actually went through this with an emergency room visit.
Yeah.
And I had no idea what they were talking about. And I say this to everybody, even when family members call me, just send it to me in writing. But with them in particular, I said, I don't know who this is. Like, I owed money to the emergency doctor.
Okay.
And I had already paid off the emergency room, and I don't know who the emergency doctor is. I have never heard, like...
It sounds wrong off the... Right.
Well, ultimately, I told them, send me a letter and whatnot, but that's the first thing you should do, is always ask for whatever claim you're getting in writing.
Right.
And then they are obligated to provide that within 5 days.
That phone call triggers the clock on the five-day window. So now they've got to send you that letter explaining. But then you can do is just shut down the phone call and say, don't call me back.
It occurs to me that the number of debt collectors that actually make that five-day window, they have to post it, right?
But within 5 days. It's the mailbox rule.
Yeah, so they got to post it within 5 days. Like, I would assume that none of them have, like, that type of process that is set.
Yeah, some of the big ones are probably pretty good at it. I've caught two of them personally myself that were trying to get collection on me. They would call me up and then I'd be like, what's this about? And I would confirm my identity. Yes, I'm Jared Johnson. Here's the last four of my social. I'd tell them all that stuff. And then they would say, well, this is who we are. We're trying to collect this. And then I would get no letter. I mean, it would go 2-3 weeks, no letter. So then I would turn around and then file suit against them. And then they would be like, we just want to pay you this money. And they would. They would actually give me like $1,000, $1,500, something. Pay my attorney his fees as well. Right off the bat, case closed. I win. Just for that, nothing else.
Okay. So, in general, the rule of thumb is answer the phone, talk to the debt collectors, force them to send you documentation at that point. And then
to pay on that first phone call. Don't try and make an arrangement. They'll try and push you to get an arrangement going. Be like, no, I got to first see what this is about before I get an arrangement set up with you. And then we can talk about it later.
All right. Talk to me about one thing you'd mentioned to me last night was the rules governing debt collection have expanded to include institutions that are not. Debt collectors per se,
A lot of states are now expanding their own state law in order to treat not just debt collectors but original creditors as debt collectors as well. Like they also have to operate under specific guidelines. And so California, by far the most consumer friendly state in the country, by far. And so in California, the law is called Rosenthal. The Rosenthal Act has been around, but it does, and it gets expanded probably regularly by California legislatures because of the fact that court decisions are coming down routinely in federal levels that are undermining the rules and regulations of debt collection practices. So then these state lawmakers will come up and fix it. Like, okay, well, so you can't sue in a federal court for that anymore. You can sue in our court.
Is that a function what is that a function of, the softening of these protections on a federal level?
It's coming from debt collectors actually litigating a lot of this stuff now and actually trying to get favorable decisions in order for them to continue harassing and abusing consumers.
Okay.
And so when they, you know, like... I'll give you an example. We're going to lead into this. One of the big developments as of lately is a software company called HCI LiveVox. It is a software that they are now selling to debt collectors that now undermines and technically overrides the capacity of the Telephone Consumer Protection Act. What it does is the Telephone Consumer Protection has two or three elements. One of the elements has to be a call that is auto-dialed from a computer that has the capacity to store and dial random sequential numbers to mobile devices without consent is a violation of the law. So they're like, well, we can get around that. So what we'll do is we will pay this guy in a third world country to tap on his keyboard all day long, loading numbers in a hopper, so that now there's human interaction to dialing numbers, and then the numbers get dialed anyways, and now there's no violation of the TCPA. And so even though it's clearly being auto-dialed, Sam,
but
there's not a person dialing numbers like, you know, grandma's phone with the gray buttons. It's not that. They're loading 10 or 15 numbers at a time with a guy hitting a space bar. And then they load them into this hopper, and then they go out and get called. But because this guy was touching a computer somewhere,
wow,
this is now considered human interaction.
So, okay.
And it breaks that.
And so states are going to hopefully step in with legislation.
Oh, I hope so. Because
what's not going to happen with Congress?
Five federal courts have now sided with HCI LiveVox.
Wow.
Five.
Okay. All right.
So it's bad for consumers.
Okay. So circling back. So California, one of the most progressive and consumer-friendly states, if not the most consumer-friendly. And we were talking about the expansion of these laws to apply to the original creditors. So if I have a Citibank credit card and I'm
and
behind
Citibank harasses you repeatedly. Yeah,
same
you go
thing
after
applies
them in California.
Now. What other states?
We were just talking to a guy from West Virginia. West Virginia also, and Virginia, D.C. These states have Colorado amended its law to say that debt buyers are also considered debt collectors because of the Gorsuch decision we talked about in the last time. Because the Gorsuch Supreme Court decision ruled that a debt buyer like Santander, the case is Henson versus Santander, that Santander bought a debt and then they tried to collect on it. And then Henson sued Santander saying you're a third-party debt collector. Supreme Court disagreed. No, they're a debt buyer, and they inherit the same rights as an original creditor and not subject to the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. Colorado went literally the next week, like, wrote new law.
All right, let me just make sure that people understand that Santander ruling. So what happens is, let's just say, for the sake of argument, Citibank issues you a credit card.
Default.
And you owe them $5,000.
It's discharged.
It's discharged in bankruptcy.
Yeah, it's not discharged. What I mean is it's like written off after 180
days. It's written off in
days.
Citibank.
After 180 days, they have to.
Okay. And so Citibank could then hire a debt collector to come after you. And because they're a third party trying to collect on Citibank's debt, they are subject to the debt collecting laws. But if Santander comes in and says, okay, we're not a debt collector. We're going to buy your debt.
We're going to buy the debt.
We're going to buy it off of you. It's
$5,000,
but we're going to pay you $500,
right,
and we're just going to make a bet that we can collect on it.
Mm-hmm.
Now that we own the debt, we have the same rights that you did originally, even though, I mean, it's absurd because they're not out $5,000.
No.
They're out $500.
No, exactly right.
And so they never, but they get all the rights as if they had lost $5,000.
All the rights. It's
and,
so
and
stupid.
So, and well, I mean, this is the nature of what happens when you get someone like Gorsuch on the court.
Yeah.
This is what you see.
Elections have consequences, I'm
yes.
afraid.
Okay, so tell us what should people do who are listening to this if they have questions? I mean, I know you told me last night that you... you get a lot of questions.
Oh my gosh!
On do I even want to say that or?
We do. We get a lot of questions on Facebook. You can go to facebook.com/SueTheCollector, and you can visit our page and ask us anything you want on our We're on Facebook Live right now, so we have about 20,000 people that subscribe to our page, which is pretty good. We're hoping to pump that up.
So you will answer those questions.
We do it every day. And, yeah, so, like, you know, a lot of people, and this is the sad part, a lot of people actually send me messages about, I got a notice to go to court, I couldn't make it to court, now my wages are being garnished, what do I do? Not much. It's too late. And so if you get sued or a debt collector is trying to sue you before they get that default judgment, man, there's a million things you can do. There's a lot of things you can do to get that stuff stalled, delayed, or even thrown out. But if you don't show up for court, you're out. I mean, there's not all these debt collection attorneys basically will stay away from you from that point forward because it's really hard to like reverse a default judgment because you didn't show up. So that's it. Now they can garnish your wages and get that money. And the money may not even be owed, which is the sad part. It may be wrong.
Right.
And so you got to show up. So.
And there's rarely any recourse once a court has decided that you are in default.
Unless the service was incorrect, meaning the sheriff never came to your house and serviced you, so they didn't obtain service, then you can get the whole thing set aside. And then, you know, it'll go before a judge, and you can be like, I never got any paperwork about a lawsuit being filed against me. Now, here's the other thing. And I really want everybody to hear this. Under the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, this is 1692I, if you are being sued by a debt collector and you're being sued in a venue that is not where you live or is in an incorrect location, so let's say you are being sued in San Diego and you live in L.A., that is a violation of the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. Wrong venue. Right on its face. Just
because they need to come to you.
They do need to come to you.
Okay.
And so the other thing is, if you took the credit card contract out and you lived in Colorado when you did it, and then you're now being sued in Wisconsin, for instance, that's illegal. Because you didn't take the contract out in Wisconsin. Being sued in an improper venue for where the contract was established.
So, so are you saying that person had moved to Wisconsin?
Yeah.
And so they need to, but wouldn't they rather be sued?
You don't live in Colorado, but that's where the law of the contract governs that contract is in the state of Colorado.
Wouldn't that be harder for you?
If
you're in Wisconsin? But this is a way.
But you could still be like, there's a whole bunch of ways to like, get around that, but at the same time, that one gets broken all the time. It happened to my wife. I wished I had known about the law at the time. We had an old credit card when we were first married, and her relatives called her and said, you know, sheriff's deputy tried to serve a lawsuit on Jenny, my wife, and you know, what was this all about? And now today, fast forward, I go, oh, wow, that would have been a really great lawsuit because we could have sued them for that. Because that was served in Knoxville, Tennessee. She lived there with her relatives like a week. So it was like kind of crazy how super incorrect they got the venue, really wrong.
All right, so the bottom line is people should go to suethecollector.com. Is that what it is?
Suethecollector.com. And look, attorneys won't cost you anything if it's a FDCPA case. If it's a TCPA case, it becomes sort of like a car accident lawyer case, whereas there'll be a contingency. And so if there's a settlement, say if you got 100 phone calls, that's $1,500 a phone call. It's a $150,000 case. And if they're all illegal, that's a very big case. A lot of times the lawyer will negotiate a settlement for you. You know, they'll say, look, they want to pay you $50,000. And a lot of times the lawyer will just split it with you.
All right. Lastly, have you noticed anything? I mean, has what's gone on with the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau impacted anything from your perspective?
No, it hasn't moved either way. You know, they're not doing anything, but then exactly they're not undermining or taking any, not that I've seen, you know what I mean? They're not moving.
They're just literally totally.
Yeah, they shut it off, and it's almost like the lights are off in the office.
Weird. Okay.
And so they.
Well, I guess, thank goodness for inactivity.
Well, here's the thing. I'm frustrated with Donald Trump's people because, you know, even if he's going to nominate some super conservative guy or friend or the best people or whatever he wants to call him, but then they go in and do zero, we'll do something.
I prefer them to do zero than to do what I think they want to do.
I understand. But I'm just saying it's like you could at least, I don't know, it's just frustrating. I would like to see, because they really, I mean, the CFPB was built to protect consumers. I mean,
there's no one associated with Donald Trump's administration who's interested in protecting
consumers.
I'm very
frustrated by this administration.
You know what? I am too.
I really am.
That's a big understatement. But yes. All right, Jared Johnson.
Thank you, Sam Cedar.
The site is SueTheCollector.com. Guys, back in the studio. We've got orange T-shirts.
Oh, yes.
We've got purple T-shirts. Right, and red.
Yes.
Do you guys want to give me your T-shirt order right now?
And red.
And by the way, listeners can get their own free T-shirt off of Facebook as well. So
guys,
put me in for
if you
red.
You want to get a free T-shirt? Go to SueTheCollector.com.
One red for Michael.
Wait, what are the choices?
Red, orange, and purple. If you're not listening, Jamie, you're not going to get
green.
T-shirt.
Oh, red.
Oh, green.
Red, please.
Do we have red?
No,
there's no red.
No red.
What is it? It's orange, green, and purple.
Yeah, orange, green, and purple.
Oh, then purple. Give me a green.
I do a purple.
They're super
a green fans. For Michael.
All right.
What is that? That's super extra small, Michael?
Extra. Double XL. Small. Actually, small. Yeah,
small.
I guess a small. I don't know.
There's no small here.
Oh
no medium's
small,
fine.
I don't know.
Well, whatever.
No. They're all maybe. Some. That's
it's all just one size? Doesn't
purple.
Matter.
That's it. Yeah.
I'll rock it.
Hell yeah.
Large. Okay. And
I
an orange.
You know what would be cool? What would be cool is if you...
In life. So these shirts will accommodate your large ass down the line.
Okay.
You know.
Right. You can grow into these.
You can grow into it. Sam, I'm like 30 years behind
Sam,
you.
Thank you so much.
You know what would be funny is if they said like these shirts are $10 and then they just taught people how to not pay for them? Like it was like an instructive lesson. It's like, whoa.
All right,
call me back.
All right, coming now, Archie Lamb is going to join us. We're going to be talking about opioid litigation that is starting to happen across the country. Archie, welcome. Just you are from which law firm?
Levin Papantonio.
There you go. Levin Papantonio, of course, Mike Papantonio's firm. Archie, give us, last time we were here, we spoke to a couple attorneys, one of whom was from Levin Papantonio as well, about the opioid litigation. Give us a broad overview. I mean, people can go back and listen to those two interviews that we did in October, but for the sake of people who are new, the litigation is going at a specific player in the sort of the chain of, I guess, distribution and manufacturing of opioids. Tell us who it is.
Yeah, we really are focusing on the distributors, with the manufacturers as being partners with the distributors in a gross oversupply through illegal diversion means of opioids to people in every community in America.
What does that mean, illegal diversion means?
Okay, so it's better for me to take it that sort of out of the hypothetical and the abstract, specific. Kermit, West Virginia is a town of about 2,000 people. Over 7 million pills were distributed to that community over a one-year period of time.
Over a one-year period of time?
Yeah.
I can't do the math.
And
but
under
that's...
the Controlled Substances Act, a federal law, distributors primarily, and the manufacturers jointly and severally have an obligation to report, to investigate, and to stop shipments that are suspicious or outside the norm. And since 2,000, 500,000 people have died as a result of oversupply of these dangerous and addictive drugs, and these companies never adhere to their obligation under the law to report and stop these excessive shipments because they're making too much money.
Now, my understanding is that these distributors in particular, they have the highest level of statutory obligation to track this stuff.
Yes.
And that they have, that they, there's a couple of things that they have done, allegedly, to sort of skirt that obligation, ranging
they
from...
They didn't skirt it. They ignored it.
They ignored it, but that they tried to justify it by sort of like leaving out years where the levels of distribution, because they're supposed to report something that seems suspicious as defined by out of the norm. And so they would play with certain years in data to try and make that look normal.
Early on, there were some playing with, to use your term. Ultimately, and Paul Farrow, who's lead counsel in the case, used this analogy, metaphor yesterday. It's like going 100 miles an hour in a school zone. They weren't going, you know, 70 in a 65. And they ignored it blatantly. They were told in 2006 and 2007 by the lead prosecutor of the DEA to stop it. These are your duties. Stop it. And they ignored it. And over the years, while they would pay, you know, fines that were really infinitesimal relative to the money they were making, they thumbed their nose at the DEA. And finally, in June of 2016, the District Court of Appeals in Washington, D.C., found in a case called Masters Pharmaceutical that what Joe Renazzisi and his colleagues at the DEA had been saying for all these decades about their failure to adhere to their and abide by their federal law obligations, then in the Masters decision, the court said, yes, you, this is your job, you failed to do it, and we're stripping you of your right to distribute.
Okay, and then there was also, I think, and I feel like this happened around last October, maybe in September, or perhaps it was, there was attempts, there was a big lobbying campaign that was exposed maybe around that time by these distributors. And we're talking only about like three or four of the major ones, is that right?
Well, three companies, there are over 700 distributors or 700 registration licenses. Three companies, AmerisourceBergen, Cardinal Health, and McKesson, controlled 85 to 90% of the distribution. And so we call those the big three, and they're the targets along with their other registrants that have failed to abide by the CSA in terms of reporting, halting, and investigating illegal shipments, and the manufacturers and failing to follow the and abide by the federal law.
And they've been lobbying to try and loosen the restrictions on or their obligations in terms of reporting this stuff.
Well, they actually were successful in passing an amendment in 2016, 2015 that repealed the really teeth of the enforcement mechanism of the DEA. And that was exposed in the 60 Minute piece. And Senator Marino from Pennsylvania, who was being suggested by President Trump to be the czar of opioids, was a sponsor in this bill that totally
gutted
the DEA's ability to hold these guys accountable.
Okay. And so the litigation that you guys are pursuing is interesting. It is somewhat modeled on the tobacco settlement, right? On some level, at least the theory behind where the expense is absorbed by society.
Actually, Sam, it's really not. Okay, and then I'll tell you why. Tobacco's bad for everybody. It kills, period. We know the disease and all the statistics. These opioids, for many Americans, are life-saving and really important for maintaining the quality of life, particularly at end of life with intractable pain from cancer and those kinds of things. And we have to leave it to the medical care providers, the physicians, to determine when it's appropriate to be prescribed and when it's not. And so, unlike tobacco, there are good uses for it. So you can't really approach it with a shotgun saying, let's get rid of all of it. You really need a scalpel as you go through what needs to be done relative to supply.
Part of the, it seems to me, the story of this opioid addiction epidemic has been that doctors were unaware, and I imagine there was a multitude of reasons why any given doctor would be unaware, of just how dangerous these drugs were. Is that accurate?
So here's the reality. The reality is this industry, upon whom we depend for research and development, and they make all these claims about we're spending these tens of millions, billions of dollars on research, did zero research. They used a one-paragraph paper by Dr. Jick in the 1980s to say that only 1% of the people that take these opioids, OxyContin in particular in this instance, will be addicted. It was a lie.
Wasn't it the idea that OxyContin, it was time-released or something like that, and so it had a special quality as opposed to just sort of like normal opioids?
Yeah,
that,
and unlike heroin and unlike the other illicit heroin and opium that had been utilized before, the time-release mechanism and other things about OxyContin were sold to doctors with detailed people in their offices, took them to conferences, had presentations made by some of the great academic scholars and scientists saying OxyContin is revolutionary.
And those scientists and whatnot were just basing it on the check that they received from the company. The company saying, like,
yeah,
trust us here.
And by the way,
and so the theory was that, like, it's time release dosage is under the threshold of what it would take for a normal person to get addicted. So therefore, hey doc, this isn't just for this person who is in in the last days of their life, but it's also for the guy who just had surgery on his
chronic
knee
pain, whether it's toothaches or torn ACLs or shoulder surgery or carpal tunnel syndrome. They said it's good for everything because it's not addictive.
Okay, so are doctors now more educated? I mean, is there a sense? Because my understanding is that it's much harder to get these prescribed at this point.
All right, so let me give you my perspective. I have represented doctors for 20 years against the health insurance companies over reimbursement disputes. I have been to doctors' meetings from California to Maine to Florida, Arizona. There is no harder working, finer, higher-minded group of people in our country than America's physicians. Do you realize that 3% of doctors are responsible for this overprescribing? The industry wants to point the finger at the doctors because it's an easy target. They want to point the finger at the addict because it's an easy target. Because we don't really have time as citizens to stop and think about it. You know, most people want to blame the addict first, the doctor second, the pharmacist third, and most of them don't even know what a distributor is. The person with the highest duty to be the policeman, to monitor where these opiates are going, were responsible for half a million murders over the last 17 years. It's a fact.
So the litigation is going in, and you're representing whom? Who are the clients?
Well, our clients are primarily cities, towns, and counties. And, those definitions, you know, townships or parishes. It's the local governments, okay? It's not the federal government, which, by the way, they're going to participate in this, as well they should. It's not the state governments and their attorneys general that are going to participate because they're Medicaid expenses. So many expenses, Sam, fall outside Medicare, outside Medicaid, on the communities who are already underfunded.
Let me just explain that part, because I don't know if that's obvious to people, but obviously, if you create an epidemic of opioid addiction, the federal government is going to pay for that via Medicaid or Medicare, in providing services for those people, whatever subsequent services that they need. And the Medicaid comes in because the states administer that. That is the similarity, I guess, in terms of the tobacco litigation was attorney generals banded together, and it was because of the cost, the externalities. Well, that tobacco smoking and really the profit made from tobacco was imposing on state
the health care delivery system that the state had to fund. And in Florida in particular, Levin Papantonio was responsible largely for helping craft the law that said the state should be reimbursed for their Medicaid expenses. This is different. This is, you know, a man is working at the factory. He blows out a disc. He gets put on OxyContin. He gets addicted. He loses his job because he can't get enough and he can't function. He loses his family. So he loses insurance. He loses his home. He's essentially homeless or traveling around or in a group of people. We've all seen it. It turns into a zombie land in many places in this country, West Virginia, Ohio in particular. There's zombie lands of addicts that have lost everything. And so while they are indigent, they don't have access to the health care facilities that normal people would, and therefore they fall outside Medicaid. So what happens is the county jails, the city jails, become the emergency room for the addicts. And that's not paid for by any governmental entity. That is paid for by the resources of the cities, towns, and counties because they have to fund it.
Okay. And so they're your clients. And then and I actually heard an interesting statistic, I think, from someone you're working with who told me that if you look at the addiction rates, that the addiction rates are much higher amongst white people, and then African Americans are second, and Latinos are much less, and that's a function of an inverse proportion to the amount of medical care that was available to you.
Okay, so
am I explaining that correctly?
Yeah. Well, here, let me do it this way. Let's go to a different angle. 4 out of 5 CDC statistics show that 4 out of 5 heroin addicts got started with a legitimate prescription drug. Now, you and I have been doing this a long time. The demographics know. The prescription drug only comes if you can pay for it, which means you probably got insurance. So sociodemographically, that's sort of a given, right? And so, yes, the whites are far more subject to opioid overdose and death than the other.
Because they have more access to health insurance.
Correct.
It's just bizarre.
That's crazy, right?
It's crazy. Okay. And so, and then the other idea is that one of the things that I think my understanding is that you're working on is creating trustees, some type of trustee system, so that the money that is raised on behalf of your clients is expended in a nuanced way relative to the needs of any given community.
All right. So, again, let me remind you that I've represented doctors and their representatives for 20 years. This is an epidemic that needs proper treatment, proper recovery plans. That can only be prescribed by doctors. And so what the industry's done, if they've vilified the doctors who, by the way, many of the doctors who are responsible for over-prescribing had already been suspended. Their license been suspended by the state boards. In other words, the doctors were held accountable. They lost their license. They lost their ability. Many of them went to jail. So the system protected the public from that. The problem is the industry circumvented that by giving access and the ability to prescribe to bad doctors. And so what the physician community is doing now, because they do believe that they are the ones that need to be prescribing medically assisted treatment for life, and do you do Suboxone for life? How does that work? How do you give these people the best chance to recover? And the thing that's most amazing to me is these doctors are on the ground all day, every day. They have patients dying in their arms. They know the nurses, they know the social workers, the people in the field that live in the sober houses. We're going through the network of physicians who are really committed to this, who've been vetted by the medical associations whom we know, who are honest brokers, and asking them, we don't want to reinvent the wheel. We don't want to take this money and create an infrastructure that doesn't exist. There are already great people out there doing great work. We want to access that. We want to tweak it. We want to fund it to the extent it needs to be funded, because that's really all they need. They have the heart. They have the effort. They have the talent. They just don't have the money. And that's what this lawsuit's about, giving them the money it takes to take care of these people.
So the awards that you're seeking on behalf of, let's say, a given county, will go to maybe people carrying Naloxone,
yeah. Suboxone, Narcan.
Some may come to help treatment centers, and some. But this is all, the idea is setting up almost like task forces that will assess what needs to happen there. Because there's also a, I guess, an interesting dynamic insofar as that there's like a, it's like equivalent to the baby boom. There is a cohort from a certain period of time, and you would know better than I when that was, where there was no awareness of this going on, and there was just like a, someone described it as a snake eating a Volkswagen, and it's just going to travel through the system, this big cohort of people who were prescribed from, I don't know when it was.
1990 to 2005, okay? That population of people who became addicted from 1990 to 2005 are in the snake, and there's nothing we can do to extract them. Two things need to happen. We need to, and some of it's happening. Controlling the prescriptions on the front end is important. The problem is that you, that will push, and we know this because in 2008, 2009, they made OxyContin incapable of being broken down, snorted, and melted so you could shoot it up. And so that pushed millions of people to heroin. So there's not, it doesn't end with the prescription.
Right.
So they stopped the prescription. We know that it goes to heroin, then it goes to fentanyl. It's a continuum that is just, you can count on it the way the sun is going to come up tomorrow. Those people are going to be addicted. So this cohort from 1990 to 2005 are in the snake. The mortality statistics are going to continue to go up. We're only in the second or third year of that manifesting because there's like a 10 to 15 year latency period before it really manifests in death. So prescription drugs, heroin, fentanyl, that's going to happen to those. And so the people since 2005 are the people that we want to address relative to real chances to help them recover, help them get to sober homes, get them medically assisted treatment for life, and those types of things that the doctors are really working hard to do. And then
the idea is that you have different cohorts who have different specific types of needs, and they have to be addressed. So whatever awards you get have to be, there has to be a system that is flexible enough and sensitive enough to be able to address the different sort of cohorts of people who have suffered from this and the context is in which they're done in terms
that's
of...
That's right, the and it's on a continuum. You know, 26% of the kids born in Cobble County, West Virginia, have an opiate addiction. 26% of the babies, okay? That's something we can do something about for the next babies. But when a child, when a small child or a young person is affected by opium, what it does to their brain changes it forever, and you really can't correct it ever. They will remain with the best care possible, wealthy family, everything that you can give them. Rob Valick, our dear friend in the University of Colorado, says they at best they got a 50-50 chance of not relapsing into drug addiction.
Wow. So you're dealing with on kids like that, neurological disorders and also a predisposition to becoming opioid addicted later in life because
they get the rewiring of the brain. But the other thing you get, and you know, we represent a lot of Native American tribes. You know, this is a group of people that have what's called intergenerational trauma. And we can go into that story forever. But when you give a citizenry that already is suffering from lack of behavioral health and mental health anyway, okay, and you give them these drugs that quote, you know, help ease the pain but lead them to a life of addiction. And by the way, you know, it's intentional. After some point in time, it was intentional. At some point in time, the foreseeability of what was happening to these people was known to the distributors and the manufacturers who poured it relentlessly into these communities. They can't claim ignorance of the consequences. They can't claim ignorance of the reality of the predisposition of people through depression or other economic problems to be subject to being addicted.
So how does the litigation work? Do you guys do a trial for a specific community, just hypothetically in Ohio or in West Virginia? And based on that trial against, one of these distributors or all of them.
And the manufacturers.
Okay, and
case.
The manufacturers. And the court in West Virginia finds for the plaintiffs this specific community and awards them a dollar figure X. At that point, do you go to the distributors and the manufacturers and say, like, okay, look, in that community, it was 3,500 people, we got X. Here's a list of 100 other communities with populations ranging from 5,000 to 25,000, and we're going to take, X equals 3,000, and we're going to multiply X by this amount. That's what you got to start doing, and we've set up these trusts here. Is that theoretically how you want it to go? Is that how it works?
Okay, so kinda. So here's what happens. We have to hire experts in behavioral health, in addiction, in pharmacology, in treatment, to create a model that says if you have 10,000 addicts in your community, in this range of addiction, from 1 to 15 years of addiction, this is what it's going to cost you to treat them. Some of them are going to die. They'll pull them out of the system. Most of them are going to relapse over the course of the next 20 years. And so you put together the cost of doing that.
And you're going to have X amount of children who are born with addiction, and they're going to cost
this. How do you
treat them? Okay.
That's right. And so we basically have three buckets of damages, really. There's the education and prevention and deterrence, which is really important and shouldn't be ignored.
So that's the going forward part.
That's right. There is the public safety, law enforcement, first responders, all those people that are on the front lines, that they're dealing with it in an emergency situation. How do we support them? And then next you have the treatment, which is emergent when they're overdosing and close to death. And then what do you do after that? Which is a continuum that may last 30, 40 years. And so it's amazing what these men and women, these healthcare economists can do relative to putting that plan together. And so it's based on not just population, it's based on addiction within the population, dosage, duration, those things. So it's really, you do try the case, you do create these metrics of damages that you then take and you use that bellwether trial to create the metrics, then you superimpose those metrics on each and every other community. You create
create an algorithm, essentially.
That's exactly right.
And
that's a better word.
And that's what the bellwether case does.
Help create
and
those.
And then you have
elements.
Your inputs that you go from community to community.
Yeah.
So has the bellwether case happened yet?
No. In fact, it's ironic. Yesterday, the judge issues an order setting in March of 2019 trials in Cleveland, Ohio, in federal court.
Is that where,
in front
is,
of him.
Is that going to be the bellwether case?
Well,
or is that where people are hoping?
It's a complex order. There are a number of states and plaintiffs that he has set out to be scheduled to go to trial. There's six or eight entities that will go to trial in certain places around the country that will create this damages metric based on the outcome of those trials. And that gives some definition, if you will, to the algorithm.
What are these companies doing now in between, if the case is happening in 2019, what are they doing now? Are they just basically saying, like, we're already in for a penny, in for a pound, we might as well just keep trying to generate as much cash as we can?
No. What they're doing now, Sam, is going to come as a shock to you, is working the hell out of Washington, D.C.
Right. They're just trying to
get legislation to bail them out of this crisis that they created.
Some type of immunity or liability?
Immunity would be where they start.
Jeez.
That, look at me, brother, that's happening. And they're working it hard, and they have the most talented lobbyist in the world, and they're working people to death in D.C. at every level, in every committee. Check it out, monitor it, get your people on it. Our people are on it because they are going to try to bail themselves out because they've been caught red-handed murdering 500,000 people since 2000.
And now it seems to me the next 12 months, I mean, there's going to be a different Congress in 12 months. It's going to be much harder if you have a Republican Senate.
They're trying to get a lot of stuff done between now and November. You can write that down.
Well, Archie Lamb, thank you so much. Where can people get more information if they just want to continue to pursue? Is there a site set up?
Google Evan Papantonio, and as you know, Paps, you can get information on Mike Papantonio. Just Google the law firm, go to the law firm website, and it'll be easy to.
Is there data access there about any of this stuff?
Oh yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. We have a lot. The firm's involved in so many different cases, but just do the opioid litigation, Levin Papantonio, and we got plenty of information on the website. All we right. represent over 400 cities, towns, and counties right now, and it'll probably be 1,000 by the end of the year.
Wow. Archie, thank you so much.
Thanks, Sam.
All right, folks. Now, I've got a couple more guests who are coming, but it's a little catch-as-catch-can. So maybe what we should do is take some phone calls and maybe play some sound. Yeah.
Take the first call. We have one person on the line if you want to take that out of the gate.
All right, let's do that.
All right. Yep. Calling from a 703 area code. You there?
All right, folks. I got a couple more guests who are coming, but it's...
Oh.
That sounds a lot like me.
It's on delay, huh? You there?
Take some phone calls.
All right, drop them.
Okay.
All right, let's go...
The lines are open, though. 646-257-3920.
I just got sent this, that apparently Ben Sasse, Senator Ben Sasse, says that Trump has reaffirmed multiple times the idea that the TPP would be easier to join now. He looked Larry Kudlow right in the eye and said, get it done.
Totally different situation.
I need to read more about what the implications of that are. But
well, it's almost like the unconventional candidate who is more dovish than Hillary and would kill bad trade deals isn't exactly doing that.
I got to say, I'm shocked.
Yeah, I did not anticipate that.
If there was one thing that I felt I knew about Donald Trump, he was a man of his word.
Right. Yep.
And that is really just, that is upsetting to hear.
That's shocking. Do you want me to try this person again?
Well, let's...
Okay. Yeah, go ahead.
I mentioned at the top of the show that Donald Trump has outpaced both Barack Obama and George W. Bush, both of them who had some majorities. My guest is here. Hi.
I'm not your guest.
Oh.
Should be your guest.
Okay. Hi. I can't talk to you now because I'm doing
Go
a show.
Go away.
Sorry.
I'm doing a program.
I cannot. I'm doing a live
no
show
picture. Nope.
Now, oh, I see that you're talking into a microphone. Can I come up and have a conversation with you?
That was great.
All right. So,
can we find a way to get that lady to do that again?
Well, it was just like
that was really funny. You know what it was? It was the second time, like when you gave the whole like, "Hey, I'm sort of in the middle of something," and she was just like, "Oh no, I'll keep talking." That was great.
Yeah, what's her story?
I guess I could find out, but it could be anything. We're in Las Vegas.
It could end up being a real mess, and we would be in an invidious situation of trying to clean it up.
Chaotic.
I don't want to have to cry on this broadcast. All right. I think. We've mentioned this multiple times, and it's getting even more extreme. And this happens outside of, I guess the you don't tend to see this, but Donald Trump has placed more judges in his now, I guess, 16 months in presidency, federal judges at this time in his presidency significantly more than Barack Obama and George Bush, almost like not quite 2-1, but significantly more judges. These judges are getting lifetime appointments, and they are nuts. Here is judicial nominee Wendy Vitter. She is a nominee for a circuit court. This is a lifetime appointment. Here she is talking about, you ready for this? And I know this is still a little bit controversial, whether or not she supports segregation.
Do you believe that Brown versus Board of Education was correctly decided?
Senator, I don't mean to be coy, but I think I get into a difficult, difficult area when I start commenting on Supreme Court decisions, which are correctly decided and which I may disagree with. Again, my personal political or religious views, I would set aside. That is Supreme Court precedent. It is binding. If I were honored to be confirmed, I would be bound by it, and of course I would uphold it.
Do you believe it was correctly decided?
And again, I will respectfully not comment on what could be my boss's ruling, the Supreme Court. I would be bound by it, and if I start commenting on I agree with this case or don't agree with this case, I think we get into a slippery slope.
Slippery slope. Brendan just said slippery slope is the new dog whistle.
I mean, we're talking about a landmark case that has the idea of segregated, separate but equal being... inappropriate is too controversial for her to affirm was ruled correctly. I mean, this is shocking. This is shocking. And she very well may probably end up with a lifetime appointment to the federal court. And make no mistake about it, maybe not. I don't know that Donald Trump is going to win a second term, but if he does, she'll be on the bench for 4 or 5 years, and maybe she moves up the ladder and becomes a Supreme Court nominee, where she will not be bound by that precedent.
I think. Do you think she's also? This is a secondary point, but you know, all of these people, Gorsuch and you know the rest, are so committed to not answering any questions about this stuff that if you draw a marker of like, I'm not even going to comment on that case, then certainly I'm not going to tell you like how I'd vote in an abortion decision. Like,
well,
that creates a lot of space. Like, I'm not answering anything, including, you know, beyond established sort of law and basic ethics.
Do they ever? I feel like most Supreme Court confirmation hearings, most judge confirmation hearings are a bunch of people trying to figure out what they believe about different things and the nominees refusing to say.
To some degree. That was a pretty extreme step there.
And, yeah, exactly. Like,
that was exceptional.
It's so stupid. Like, obviously, these people have political views and the decisions are heavily mediated by that, but then they have to find this completely irrelevant
law.
Right. Legalistic explanation for
it.
Here's the difference. Here's the difference. They're not asking her political view. She's not saying like, do you find it repulsive to have to live amongst black people? That is not.
That's not what they're asking.
They're asking the, do you think it was properly decided? I mean, I think there are people in the past who have said, who support abortion rights, who will say, like, well, I'm not convinced that Roe v. Wade, the strongest part of the decision was basing it on privacy, let's say.
And
for an example, in that same hearing, apparently she was asked about abortion rights. And she said, I am pro-life. I will set aside my religious or personal views. My personal views in this role, I need to make a conscious effort and will do so to set that aside.
Yeah,
right. At one point, exactly. But at one point, she apparently was on the record as saying in 2013, That Planned Parenthood says they promote women's health, she said. It's the saddest of ironies that they kill over 150,000 females a year. The first step in promoting women's health is to let them live.
Do you think, though, but also in previous, I've seen them say, not only getting away from settled law, I've actually seen a couple of them answer, like, what do you think was a well-crafted decision in case? And right. They've named it. So, and they always do pick something like that, which is uncontroversial and from the past, and supposedly we've all bought into. Although I do wonder if we brought Sam Harris into this, if he would say, like, maligning her as a judge.
Yeah, let's not get ahead of ourselves.
Wow.
See, Mike, I know, that was really a stretch. That was a stretch.
Sam Harris on your
that
mind.
That was a stretch. Right, yeah, well, as always. That, he really is my Jimmy Dore.
Well, I mean, Jimmy Dore also seems to be your Jimmy Dore.
that's your stretch.
You can have more than one.
No, yeah.
We can all have more.
Wait, who's your second Jimmy Dore?
Mine?
Yeah.
Probably just you.
well, I thought that would go without saying. I mean, of course, you're my enemy. Yeah.
Structurally.
Yeah, structurally and personally. I mean, I do the impression of you more than anything about Harris.
We're supposed to get Cenk Uygur, supposed to be here in 12
minutes. Of course!
So we can ask him about that. Cynthia Nixon has... what is this? Is this? I'm confused in what's this listed here.
She talked about marijuana.
Okay, yeah, let's listen to this. This, of course, Cynthia Nixon... running for governor against Andrew Cuomo, and already with a lot of impact. Now, Cuomo is backtracking, or I should say, I don't know how to phrase this, has evolved into a different understanding. No, I've got Cenk Uygur coming. Coming to a different understanding of the Independent Democratic Caucus. This is a conference, which is a caucus of elected Scats. As Democrats. Yeah. Elected as Democrats to the New York State Senate, but caucuses with Republicans for literally for money. like they get higher salaries. They get better offices. Hmm. They get a choice. Positions literally get more budget.
I'm all of a sudden mapping a different political career for myself. No, I didn't realize it was that good.
It's awesome. It sounds ridiculous. Like, like, how is this legal? Well, the party in power gets to allocate the resources that are allotted to the state Senate, and they give more of it to these guys. And Cuomo has completely enabled this, but Cynthia Nixon's campaign has been so effective so quickly that he has now said he is going to crush the IDC. And however, it comes very late, particularly after the budget has already been drawn up. But nevertheless, here's Cynthia Nixon moving on to the next issue. And, you know, we had earlier in the program, we had Jared Johnson on, who said that California is the most consumer-friendly state in the country. And there is no reason why New York State should not be competing for that title. And we see this across the board in a multitude of aspects of society in California. And they do this because they have they are controlled by basically elected officials who range from the center left to the left. And that should be the case in New York State as well. But here's Cynthia Nixon talking about legalization of marijuana.
Hi, I'm Cynthia Nixon. A lot of you have been asking about my position on marijuana. So here it is. I believe it's time for New York to follow the lead of 8 other states and D.C. and legalize recreational marijuana. There are a lot of good reasons for legalizing marijuana, but for me it comes down to this. We have to stop putting people of color in jail for something that white people do with impunity. 80% of the New Yorkers who are arrested for marijuana are black or Latino, despite the fact that whites and people of color use marijuana at roughly the same rates. The consequences follow people for the rest of their lives, making it harder to get jobs or housing, and for non-citizens, putting them in the crosshairs for deportation. In addition to ending a key front in the racist war on drugs, regulating and taxing marijuana would generate hundreds of millions of dollars of tax revenue for our people and create important agricultural opportunities for our state. In 2018, in a blue state like New York, marijuana shouldn't even be an issue. If there was more political courage coming out of Albany, we would have done this already. The simple truth is, for white people, the use of marijuana has effectively been legal for a long time.
That's true.
Isn't it time we legalize it for everybody else?
I mean, she hits all the bases there. And you know, one thing to keep in mind, I mean, obviously, I agree with every point she made in favor of marijuana legalization. From a political standpoint, the key for Cynthia Nixon is going to be to win downstate New York City. And maybe just to draw inroads there. When Zephyr Teachout got 37% against Andrew Cuomo, she won big time upstate. Andrew Cuomo is heavily disliked upstate for a variety of reasons. And Cynthia Nixon is trying to appeal to downstate voters, to New York City voters, and to African-American Latino communities in a big way. And so I think that's why, to a certain extent, she was pretty savvy in making sure that the legalization argument was framed as a, in many respects, a social justice argument as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that is the most important reason. Like, it's nice, it would be great to be able to buy weed at the store, but, like, the single most important reason is exactly what she said.
Which is that you need to buy weed at the store more easily. I think, I mean, I guess, though, it'll be a really interesting exercise in patronage politics over the next several months, right? Because Cuomo's just going to try to counteract that by locking down every single, like, machine network in New York City, which, you know, that's... someone IM'd a couple weeks ago a really smart observation that it's actually going to be in deep blue states, probably much harder in the short term to elect, like, real, you know, more progressive candidates like Cynthia Nixon, because of the sort of more machine structures in the Democratic Party.
We'll see.
I mean, hopefully. I mean, I hope she can. Seems like she's on course in the worst event to very least take a nice dent out of him and hobble him for 2020, which he clearly is thinking about.
Can yes. I ask a question? Why do New Yorkers vote for him? Like, seriously, what does he have to offer them? I heard the turnout was pretty low in some of these elections. Is that right?
Oh, it's always yeah. low. But what do you think? I mean, I think in the beginning it was he delivered social progress and took care of Wall Street and promoted charter schools, which was actually pretty effective when he first came into office.
Let's talk a little bit about Syria at this point. We don't know what's going on. It's interesting. And, you know, I've been obviously not had in my normal routine of watching hours and hours of cable news. but it appears to me, at the very least, that the prospect of bombing Syria now is different. The way that it's been addressed in the media is slightly different than it was a year ago, frankly, in the hours before we bombed Syria.
And, a bit more skeptical.
It's a bit more skeptical, and it seems like there is actually some critical thought about, okay, what is there going to be a strategy? Like, does not seem to be, I mean, I guess to the extent that Trump has articulated one, the only thing that he has articulated is that we should leave Syria, and then I don't know, I guess has changed its mind, or it's not quite clear on that, but there just seems to be, I sense a little bit more skepticism. And here is Jeffrey Sachs on Morning Joe making the argument that it is time to get out of Syria. And, you know, I don't know what theoretically is supposed to happen if we bomb Damascus and then say, and incidentally, we're leaving. I mean, what other than just creating more suffering on top of the already suffering, what do we create there? But here's Jeffrey Sachs.
So Jeffrey Sachs, chime in. This is very different than just a war between two countries. This is as convoluted as it gets and could get out of control. I don't think people might really conceptualize, maybe even not this president, how out of control this could escalate.
It's true, but I think we have to step back and not put this in partisan terms. This is a U.S. mistake that started 7 years ago. And I remember the day on your show when President Obama said, Assad must go. Mm-hmm. And I looked at you and Joe and I said, huh? How's he going to do that? Where's the policy for that?
Right.
And we know they sent in the CIA to overthrow Assad, the CIA and Saudi Arabia together in covert operations tried to overthrow Assad. It was a disaster. Eventually it brought in both ISIS as a splinter group to the jihadists that went in. It also brought in Russia. So we have been digging deeper and deeper and deeper. What we should do now is get out and not continue to throw, not have a confrontation with Russia. 7 years has been a disaster under Obama, continuing under Trump. This is what I would call the permanent state. This is the CIA, this is the Pentagon, wanting to keep Iran and Russia out of Syria, but no way to do that. And so we have made a proxy war in Syria. It's killed 500,000 people, displaced 10 million, and I'll say predictably so, because I predicted it 7 years ago that there was no way to do this and that it would make a complete chaos. So what I would plead to President Trump is get out, like his instinct told him,
he
by the way.
That, before, yeah.
That was his instinct. Right. But then all the establishment, the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Pentagon, everybody said, no, no, that's irresponsible. But his instinct is right. Get out. We've done enough damage 7 years. And now we really risk a confrontation with Russia that is extraordinarily dangerous.
Now, if I understand what he's saying, and I have to say that 7 years ago on Dylan Radigan's show, I was making the same argument that there's nothing that we can do that is good. But if I understand what he's saying, he's claiming that the entire the first vestiges of anti-Assad, I guess, protests or rebellion were inspired by the CIA.
I don't know if he's actually saying that, but I totally disagree with that. If that's what he's stating, I don't.
Yeah, that was not my understanding. Now I do believe that there has been significant reporting, and it's understood that the CIA was sending weapons in after the initial, I guess, attempts.
When things turned violent, the CIA basically worked with the Gulf states, and they funded the people they usually fund, which are right-wing Sunnis. And, you know, right. and the Assad regime had already destroyed the Syrian left. Could I just say two quick things on this? One is I do think we could do and should maintain some type of presence in Rojava and to support the Kurds. I think there's obviously always that's more could be done for refugees and humanitarian. And it seems to me that number three, What I think they're actually doing, and I don't think this is Trump's strategy, but I think even like kind of French and British, you know, sources have sort of sent these signals that it's like, and this is still totally stupid, but it's like, oh, maybe we'll just bomb an airstrip just on the principle that, like, you can't use these weapons. And it is starting to get a little bit weird. Like, why? I mean, they're horrible, but why do we fetishize it so much? Like, every faction there is killing so many innocent people with every means. I don't know why this stands out, but at any rate.
I think Obama actually had it right in supporting the Kurdish movement in Rojava with some sort of limited airstrikes. Like, I'm very afraid what's going to happen to the people there when the U.S. stops doing that. But also, I don't trust Trump to execute any of this well.
Yeah.
Never support military action by Donald Trump.
That should be a... that should be a foregone conclusion.
Right.
But I think there's really no evidence, historical evidence, that we are helpful in these situations. And there doesn't seem to be, outside of regime change, which does seem to be impossible from a practical level,
it's not gonna happen.
And not terribly justifiable on any other grounds in terms of like our making that decision. There doesn't seem to be any type of strategy here. Like, what is supposed to happen after this regime change? So it's, I don't know. Maybe I'm projecting, but there does seem to be more skepticism in the media, and I can't tell if that's just because nobody trusts Donald Trump, or if it's just like people are starting to realize like it doesn't make sense to do this. I don't know.
Well, hopes maybe it also even just what happened a year ago. He did do this. They did all embarrass themselves, and guess what? Here we are.
Yeah, they had a huge hard-on for war the last time he did that, and I hope they've learned something from it, but I don't know.
He has finally become president.
If people find value in sending a couple of missiles into the Mediterranean and saying that we struck Syria, I'm okay with that. If that will satiate the lust for war, then I'm okay with that.
Bad for the
hold
environment,
up one second.
Dude.
I think hold on one second. I think we can try it now. I was anticipating Cenk Uygur, but he may be coming a little bit late. It's Las Vegas.
All the torts buddies.
All of my torts friends.
okay, is you want to have a seat?
For those listening,
here we go.
Here's the guest. Okay.
So, Kim, could you just pull up just a little bit? Right there is great. So, Kim Daugherty, tell us where you're from. What firm?
I'm from Andrus Wagstaff, and I manage our Boston office.
And you were here. I know you were sitting on a panel, and you folks are representing whom that you were here talking about?
We represent multiple survivors of sexual assault. It could be against a university, could be against, right now, working towards representing gymnastics victims against the United States Association of Gymnasts. And we also do some workplace harassment. And now, with the new sex trafficking bill that just got signed into law yesterday, we will be working on representing women who are stuck in hotels going through the sex trafficking issues.
Well, I wasn't anticipating talking about this, but what is your perspective on SESTA, FASTA? In having talked to advocates of sex trafficking victims, they did not find this bill helpful. They saw it as creating an obstacle to locating victims of sex trafficking and a way of helping those people. What's your perspective on that?
You know, I have a little bit more trust in our law enforcement, and I believe that there will be ways to continue to help find them. The way that I see the bill is now finally clearing up a loophole that will hold these internet providers accountable. That's what the bill is about. The bill is about clearing that up and ensuring that if you are Craigslist or your Backpage, that you can't just go ahead and knowingly allow human trafficking, that you are going to be held responsible.
Well, they're allowing for advertising remedies of human trafficking. How do you anticipate folks who are victims of human trafficking, how do you anticipate them being located now?
So a lot of the ways that people find it, you could still utilize the internet and the interwebs to find people. I don't think that the bill is going to prohibit that in any way, shape, or form. So that's something that is still available and still out there. I think our law enforcement has always been doing it in various different ways, whether it be through investigating the hotels or Uber or other sort of forms of this. I think the bill itself is just more about holding these companies accountable, and hopefully it will stop what's happening. I know Craigslist immediately took down all of their ads as of the time that the bill came out.
The ads aren't there, but the trafficking is still theoretically happening, right?
Well, that's the goal, is to stop that. And if you're holding them accountable and they're going to get fined and there's going to be money and they're going to go to jail, then in and of itself is going to lead to hopefully stopping what's happening.
All right. Well, let's talk about and tell me about the nature of the litigation against the gymnastics organization. Like, what is what is the theory in which you're holding them responsible?
So there's a new law that came into effect on February 14th of this year. It's called the Safe Sport Act. And that law requires that the USAG or anyone within the line of authority or power who is told or learns about assault to report it. They have 24 hours. They're now mandatory reporters. They have to report it to law enforcement agencies. If that doesn't happen, there are civil remedies that are available to provide survivors and victims with statutory damages, costs, and attorney's fees. And punitive damages as well. So
it's sort of amazing that there hasn't been a statutory obligation for institutions like this,
right,
that are theoretically charged with. I mean, they're the organizing principle, right? These are bringing these people together. How has that been the case that there's been no statutory obligation to make sure that? I mean,
minors are being protected.
I mean, theoretically, if the U.S. gymnastics organization is bringing minors into a gym that is covered with asbestos, mm-hmm, right? I mean, they have an obligation to protect the health of those kids.
Right.
How do they not have this obligation?
Well, and particularly when they're getting paid for all of the membership, they're getting paid by the coaches who are USAG certified, when they're getting paid by the gyms that are USAG sanctioned, and doing absolutely nothing to oversee and protect the safety of minors. It's pretty incredible that it took this long, and it took a tragedy to come forward to make this change.
Is this how broad is that statute, and are there other examples of organizations that are out there that you see as potentially, you know, a problematic? I mean, obviously, the Catholic Church comes to mind. I don't know if 6 months ago someone would have said the U.S. Gymnastics Association. Mm-hmm. Are there others that people are aware of in the community that may be problematic?
I think it's rampant within the Olympic avenue, regardless of what sport you're doing. We know that swimmers also have been affected by this. We know that various other athletes out there have been affected by this issue, and it's the act itself is not specific to gymnastics. It's a safe sport act. It's all sports. So there could be any athlete that could bring this type of a claim, as long as they're a covered individual and they are a mandatory reporter. So now I think it could be anyone. It could be figure skating could be involved in these issues. And the act itself is a federal law. So it could be implemented anywhere across the country against any organization that would be a mandatory reporter.
And so are you representing, how many clients do you have in this case? How many people are you?
So We have about a dozen gymnasts that we represent. We represent some really high-profile ones. We are looking at avenues to get around some statute of limitations issues. In Massachusetts, we have a really lengthy one. You mentioned the Catholic Church cases. It's a really lengthy one because of those cases, and there are discovery rules that allow people to bring the cases within a certain period of time that they discover it. And the Safe Sport Act itself is a 10-year statute of limitation, so separate and apart from the normal 2-year or 3-year, it allows 10 years and also a discovery rule within that.
Wow. That's nice. Well, Kim, if people want to get more information on this, where would they find out?
They can go either to our website or to my direct email. Our website is www.andruswagstaff.com. That's ANDRUSWAGSTAFF.com. And my email is kim.dougherty, DOUGHERTY, at andruswagstaff.com.
Okay. Well, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you
so much.
Sorry,
grab some water.
It's an important issue.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you.
All right.
No, I was looking for it. I'm sorry.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Still. All right, folks. In just a moment, joining me, let's see if people recognize this guy sitting down here. There he is.
Who's that?
Ladies and gentlemen, this is...
Who is that?
Would you say your name?
I think it's Cenk. It's Cenk, right? Yeah, Cenk Uygur.
Cenk Uygur is joining me now,
Cenk?
Ladies and gentlemen. He can't hear you, Michael.
Oh, okay.
No.
Cenk Uygur, welcome to the program. So, a little crazy week in the news.
No. when is it ever with Trump? But yes, it is, as predicted, the centrifuges are spinning faster and faster.
Yeah. Well, let's start with Paul Ryan for a moment.
Mm-hmm.
Give me your assessment of Paul Ryan's reasons for leaving, and is he going to go home now and just sit around with his teenage boys on the weekdays?
Yeah.
He doesn't want to just see them on the weekends. He wants to see them on the weekdays. Because we all know 14-year-old boys, what they want to do is stay home at night and hang out with dad.
Yeah. He even said it in his speech that they don't really want to see him. So,
right.
One of the worst excuses ever. They use it every time. It drives me crazy when the press takes it seriously. But largely in this case, it's an obligatory mention. So the real reasons are twofold. Anyway, screw the rest of the press. We can say it. So, first of all, he had an excellent chance of losing. Not a little chance of losing. I think he had at least a 55% chance of losing. They just lost a plus 19 seat in Pennsylvania. His seat's only plus 5. It's in Wisconsin, where they had those two huge upsets that just happened. And Scott Walker waving a huge red flag going, oh, my God, we're all going to lose. We're all going to lose. And
one was a state Senate seat, and one was a state Supreme Court's seat. So much so that Walker is refusing to hold a special election, even though he's been required to by, I think, two federal courts now.
That's right. So that's the overwhelming number one reason he lost, because he didn't want to be humiliated. Even taking a 25% chance of ending your career with an unprecedented historic loss is probably too high. And in reality, his internal polling must have showed it was way higher than that. And I really thought that he was going to go down, and he will. So now I really believe that Randy Bryce, Iron Stash, is going to take his seat. And so that's going to be amazing to have a Democrat have the former Speaker of the House's seat. He's among the Just Democrats. I'm here also helping Allison Hartson, who's running in California against Feinstein. If we take those seats, imagine we have Paul Ryan's seats and Feinstein's seat and Crowley's seat and Yoder in Kansas. There's a TYT member who's up 7 points on him right now. Isn't that amazing?
That's amazing. All right, well, but let's talk a little bit more about Ryan, because so he announces now, so theoretically the Republicans have a chance to have someone run in that district. But he's also an incredible lame duck. And he also didn't want to stay there and be minority leader. But it seems to me, I mean, people are talking about him retiring. He's not retiring. He's resigning from this job. And clearly he's doing so to, in part, to not be tainted, or maybe not to be tainted by Donald Trump any further, well, so that he can run in 2020.
So that's certainly true, Sam, but I'm going to take it a step further. I think the second main reason he's retiring or resigning, and you're right, he's 48, I'm 48. He's not retiring, right? He's going to make a ton of money from being a lobbyist, consultant, whatever, right? And that's reason number three. But reason number two is that he doesn't want any part of impeachment. So impeachment is an absolute no-win for him as Speaker of the House. So what he doesn't realize is he has to leave sooner, because I think it's going to happen before the midterms.
Really?
Yeah. And so if he goes to do impeachment, the Trump base will despise him forever. He'll never get reelected to anything ever again in the Republican Party. If he doesn't do impeachment, well, then he probably has ruined his career in the opposite direction and has no principles, et cetera, if it comes to that. And I think that he thinks there's an excellent chance that it comes to that.
So you're saying that, now when you say impeachment is going to come before the midterms, like, how is that possible?
So there's two possible ways. And when I say impeachment, I mean Trump leaving office, either impeachment itself, the threat of impeachment, or firing Mueller, which then leads to the Republicans saying, OK, we're going to start to have hearings and et cetera. And at some point, Trump leaves the building with his hair on fire.
So do you think that if he fires Mueller, the Republicans are gonna hold hearings?
So
I mean, meaningful hearings?
Yeah, well, so I think that scoop that Eric Erickson got, and it's a funny sentence because the right wing almost never does real news, but for the first time ever, Eric Erickson got some news that was actually really interesting when he talked to that congressman, and the congressman off the record or anonymously just let it rip and said what all the Republicans in Congress are thinking, which is, if we don't get primaried, if we can survive the primaries, and we're going down anyway, look at our numbers, we're all going to lose, well, then, yeah, we're going to take them down with us. Yes. Because in the general election, then their only hope is to vote against Trump, to vote for impeachment. Otherwise, they're in massive, unrecoverable holes. Right now, Frank Luntz is screaming on Fox News, the House is gone and the Senate's not far behind.
And so, okay, so the theory goes like this. We get past the primaries, and then we're able to come out and be anti-Trump. And I guess the idea is that it will, I mean, because my speculation has been that the Republicans will never impeach Donald Trump, and they won't. I mean, I don't think Donald Trump leaves office before, maybe he has a heart attack or gets hit by a bus or syphilis or whatever it is. But I don't think that he is kicked out of office before 2018.
I think he is.
Really?
Not before 2020, but before 2018 ends. And there's now, this is a
now tiny, what do you anticipate coming out? That?
So, first of all, he knows he did it. Whatever it is, it's massive, because he's in an absolute panic. He's been on a panic from day one, and the closer you get, you know that game, cold, hot, right?
Yeah.
As Mueller gets closer, and when he got to Michael Cohen, he's like, hot, right? And he starts screaming. He, like, all of his lawyers keep assuming, oh, why are you going crazy? And all of his advisors, they're like, just calm down. It'll sort itself out. Because they don't know what he knows. He knows he did it. He probably did money laundering for decades for the Russians. That's a massive crime. Massive. Right? If he wasn't president and didn't have all that power and it wasn't going to rip the country apart, he'd almost certainly be going to prison. So that's why, in a panic, it would be shocking if he didn't fire all those guys. Rosenstein, Mueller, Sessions, whoever he needed to. I actually think it's a fairly high chance that he'll fire Sessions and put Scott Pruitt in his place. People look at Scott Pruitt and go, oh, my God, look at that corruption. Trump looks at him and goes, oh, my God, look at that corruption.
Right.
That's not the bug,
this
that's
is
a feature.
My kind of guy. We speak
exactly,
the same.
Exactly.
And, all right, so Scott Pruitt comes in, and then after the primaries, if I'm Donald Trump and I'm listening to this program right now.
You fire Mueller now, yes.
You do it now.
That's right.
Right? You do it before the primaries.
Yep.
And you make those Republicans who could potentially be facing primaries, you got to choose a side now.
That's
right. Not later when it's easier. You got to choose a side now.
In fact, the
smart... Do you think there's anybody who's advising? Do you think he has that type of savvy? I mean, because let me just backtrack for 1 second. I'm not so convinced, but the idea that Republicans could turn on him in the summer, let's say, trying to salvage, and not as en masse, but just each individual is like, I'm looking at my internal polling. I'm down 20 points because Donald Trump, I'm going to come out against Donald Trump, too. And maybe I'll win as a desperate ploy. I could see that happening. And then as the Republican Party would be like, and it will also force the Democrats to pick up the pace of impeachment hearings, because I don't think the Democrats want to impeach Donald Trump before 2020. Because why would you? You want this guy to hobble in.
To get a madman out of office, but politically they don't really care. Right. Okay. So I totally agree with where you were going in both directions. So number one, the smartest time to fire Mueller would have been almost right after the tax cuts. After the tax cuts passed, that's when he was at his zenith of power with Republicans and with Republican donors. And the markets were doing great. A week and a half after the tax plan, he should have fired Mueller strategically if he actually did money laundering for the Russians, et cetera, et cetera. Now, in terms of how this is going to play out for the Republicans, remember, you don't need all the Republicans in the House. All you need is a majority of the House. If all the Democrats are on board, you only need...
30 Republicans. That's right. Would be plenty.
You only need, I think, 24 Republicans to flip over. And how many Republicans are going to be minus 10, minus 12, minus 15 at that point in the summer with only a couple months left to go before their election? What turns a minus 12 around in two, 3 months?
Do you not need the Speaker of the House? I mean, could the Speaker of the House just simply say, like, we're not setting up a special... commission?
So that's why Paul Ryan's trying to get the hell out of Dodge.
So you think he wants to even leave before?
Well, so what I said on the Young Turks last night was, look, he thinks, oh, it's okay that all that impeachment stuff will come up in the next 2 years. I'm getting out in enough time, and he thinks he's being savvy, right? But the centrifuges are spinning quicker and quicker and quicker, and he might pull a Chaffetz. And when he realizes, oh, no, this is going to happen right now, he's going to go, oh, my teenagers.
I just found out my son is actually 14 and a half, not just 14.
Yeah.
I got to get back there.
That's right. They're a little younger or a little older than I thought they were. I got to go.
What about Mitch McConnell? I mean, I feel like Mitch McConnell has just been like sort of living in a hole somewhere. And he pokes his head up every now and then to say, like, Didn't I crush it with Garland? Like I won the election with Donald Trump, and we now have more federal judges than anyone could have ever possibly imagined at this point. Gorsuch is in there, and
yeah, so that makes sense. If you're Mitch McConnell, that's exactly what you want to do. Number one, you don't want to pass any legislation anymore after the tax cuts. You're done.
What's left?
Right. And literally, I read an article yesterday talking about how the 2018 legislative agenda is over. It's April.
You don't want anybody to make a vote. You don't want any of your senators to have to take a vote that they don't want to take.
These people are so useless. That's why I'm pushing for Allison Hartson for California Senate. Because, there's 1,000 bills to introduce. There's amazing things. Anyway, so Mitch McConnell... of course, he wants to go in hiding and just brag about the tax cuts and be done with it. And if you look at his calculus, number one, he doesn't like Trump. None of these guys like Trump, right? They never liked him in the first place. And he keeps insulting people in the club. And they hate that. That's the number one crime in Washington, is to insult fellow club members. Number two, he just wants the Republican Party to win. And if it looks like they're going to lose the Senate, doesn't lose much by turning on Donald Trump. And number three, they already got the tax cuts.
Right.
And so once they got the tax cuts, they don't need him at all. They just needed him to push the Overton window and push for a maniacally high tax cut.
Now, if the Republicans come out against Trump, let's say in the summer, don't you think that they're still going to pay a huge price from their own base? I mean,
yes, they're going to get slaughtered. They're going to
get slaughtered no matter what at this point.
They're going to lose no matter what. And it's, this should be called an episode that Republicans shouldn't listen to, okay? Because I don't want them knowing this stuff. But I got to be honest. That's our job, right? So, look, if they don't impeach Trump, they'll lose. If they do impeach Trump, they'll get slaughtered because all their voters will stay home.
Right. Nobody's going to get – it's not like there's a lot of – potential Democratic voters, maybe, I guess.
That they're going to win over?
Right,
no,
right.
They're not going to win over Democratic voters.
And I guess the question is just, you know, with those sort of, I guess, the Republican suburbanites. But no, the damage is done.
Yeah, I mean, damage is done in 1,000 different ways.
Do you think the Democrats are going to win the Senate?
I don't know. It depends on a couple of things. One is how big the wave is, obviously. Two is who the candidates are. No, look, I keep talking about Alison Hartson versus Feinstein because I think it's really important to take over the Democratic Party. But likely, either Alison or Dianne Feinstein will win the California seat anyway. It's not like a Republican is going to win that seat. But in states where a Republican is going up against a Democrat, it is, and it's a purple state, and it's, you know, it could go either way. It is imperative that we put up populists. Put aside progressives. Populists. People who are anti-establishment. Because the country's in a massively anti-establishment mood. And if you put up, you know, Joe Corporate, you know, you name him, and say, and he goes and brags about, oh, well, I passed tax cuts for corporations.
Right.
You know, I helped Trump do this. I helped Trump do that. Well, he has a much lower chance. Washington's completely wrong. He has a much lower chance of winning than if you've got a progressive populist out there fighting for example, Medicare for All. Every poll shows Medicare for All is super hot and super popular. Independents love it. But these knuckleheads, like, I keep going back to it because I'm so familiar with it, but Feinstein in her town hall, she's like, I'm not ready for it yet. You're 84.
Right.
You're not ready for it yet. Right? And then a week later, she goes raises money from the health insurance companies.
So I think... from the perspective, at least, of people who listen to this show, I think for the most part, I mean, I guess it's possible, but I think the vast majority of people who listen to this program would love to see Dianne Feinstein go.
Mm-hmm.
Then the question becomes, like, why not? I mean, the other big front runner is Kevin DeLeon, who's
he's a state senator.
State senator, but he's the president. Is he the... president
yeah Senate. He's in leadership in the California Senate. Why not him? First of all, super standard politician. He's taken corporate PAC money his whole career, takes money from the defense industry, on and on and on. So what are we going to do? We're going to replace Dianne Feinstein with a younger Dianne Feinstein, and for the next 40 years beg DeLeon, please, can you be progressive? Pretty please, I know you're taking all this money from corporations, but can you also consider us? Why don't we just go for an actual progressive? Elsa's got 1,500 volunteers. She outraised Feinstein and DeLeon combined among small donors in the last quarter of 2017.
Is that right?
That's incredible. That's incredible. And look at all the bias in the mainstream press. In some of the polls, they include her. She does perfectly fine right next to DeLeon. You know why? Because no one knows the guy. And so, but the mainstream press goes, if you are an establishment politician like he is, then I'm going to favor you. I'm going to call you legitimate. For every other candidate, no matter how much money they raise, no matter how many small donors they have, how many volunteers, they go, not legitimate, you're not one of my friends who's a politician. The second metric they use is just flat-out money. How much corporate money have you taken? Well, then you have helped corruption. Every paper, every TV station, radio station in California, as an example, that says that money is the only metric, and they do, all of them. That's their number one and almost only metric. They say, if you are more corrupt and you have taken more money from corporate America, you're more legitimate.
Right, of course.
But in reality, Alison Hartson's got this thing on fire, and she has all these volunteers, and there's almost no one else. KDL, no one knows him. No one knows him. So here we are. Progressives can create an earthquake in California to knock out one of the grand poobahs of the establishment, and there's no one else in the race.
Well, I will say, Michael had DeLeon on TMBS, I guess, last week. sounded like a typical politician. Maybe he should have Hartzman on.
Definitely have Allison on. Yes, because when you listen to Allison, anyone who does, all skepticism is immediately gone.
Is there any danger? Because California has this jungle primary. So theoretically, right? It should be, because of all the Democrats, there should be two Democrats running in the general election.
Yes.
Inevitably, one of them is going to be Dianne Feinstein, because she's been the sitting senator for a long time.
Likely, yes.
Is there any danger that the rest of the Democratic field will... And I have to say, the jungle primary is a horrible... This is why, like, I don't know why the California State Senate doesn't get rid of this, because...
I guess that's another problem of KDL.
Yes. But is there a danger, or let's put it this way, address the danger of Democrats splitting the votes and a Republican ending up actually running against them?
Not in California. No. Because
there's not even a danger that they're going to come in second
or
third.
No, because the Republicans in the race, first of all, no big name got in. And second of all, they're polling terribly, miserably. And by the way, so is Allison's, the state senator, her theoretical main opponent. He gets 4%. Nothing. Okay? Like, the only people who like the state senator are the media. They're like, oh, he's a state senator. Who gives a crap? Nobody knows him. He's a super standard politician, right? So, no, there isn't any chance. I mean, when Kamala Harris was being challenged by Loretta Sanchez, there was no Republican within eyesight of them, and those were bigger names running against them. They both made the runoff super
easy.
That is
sort of the point. They're both big names, so they're both going to make the runoff, as opposed to there's one big name, mm-hmm. and then a series of people that nobody knows.
It is a compelling point, so I think maybe De Leon should think about getting out of the race. Because there is a real progressive. By the way, she rose up from a volunteer to national director of Wolfpack. She organized over 30,000 volunteers across the country. She got a pass in 5 states. Okay, so she's a massive, unreal organizer. One of the smartest, most organized women I've ever met. So I don't know why he's hurting progressives by staying in the race.
Fair enough.
Yeah, I don't. I think that all of your viewers and listeners will agree to this. I don't agree that someone who's a standard greasy politician who's taken corporate PAC money their whole life is the more legitimate candidate. When they poll at the same number and no one knows him, and she outraises him like 10-1 in small donors, he is not the legitimate candidate.
If,
she is.
If you are the Senate pro temp leader and you can't outpoll the rest of the field on day one of the campaign, then that's it seems to me to be an argument that, like, you just don't have it.
He doesn't
like,
have
right?
it.
Like and that's the irony here, is that there's a certain amount of legitimacy given to him because of his status, but it doesn't translate, and that seems to be an indication that maybe there's a problem here. As opposed to the opposite, right?
Exactly right. And you know what part of the problem is, Sam? I've been watching his campaign. He does nothing, stands for nothing, and will not attack Feinstein. He's sent in there to further his career to run another race at a later time by having a good showing against Feinstein. He's not going to hit Feinstein. He has no chance of beating her in the runoff because he doesn't even want to beat her. So, sure, he'd love to be senator, but he's not willing to risk his career going after Feinstein in an aggressive way. Allison just put out an ad saying, you know why Dianne Feinstein doesn't fight income inequality? Because it works for her.
Right.
She gains from income inequality. Her husband's a billionaire. That's why she voted for Bush's tax cuts. That's why she voted to get rid of the estate tax. She is the corruption. Allison Arson's willing to say it. The other guy won't dare to say it.
If I remember correctly, too, he wouldn't even take a position on the Yemen thing that Bernie had proposed.
Allison did a video.
Feinstein even supported that, I think, if I remember.
Allison did a video out of her kitchen, not about Yemen, but about Syria the other night. going, what are we doing? This is the same lead up to the Iraq war. Don't do it. Don't do it. It's like the other guy is going to get together his kitchen cabinet and 30 days later come up with a, you know, polled, consultant-approved position on Syria. She grabs a phone and she's like, for God's sake, don't do it.
All right. Let's. So what's Allison's website? Do you have
AllisonHartson.com. And so you can go AllisonHartson.com/now to volunteer. We actually emphasize volunteers even more than donations because you got to. We're trying to get to a 2,000-person army for Allison to go cover the state.
When is the primary itself?
But let me just give the link to the donations too, because no corporate PAC money, so she's got to do it with small donors. It doesn't matter if it's $3, $5, just get in the fight. It's justicedemocrats.com/Allison, okay? justicedemocrats.com/Allison. Now, Allison's with one L, okay? So the primary is less than 2 months away. It's June 5th, okay? So these things come on you so quick, and so she's running, like, one ad after another, fighting for progressive policy positions. He's not even running any ads. So, like, for example, your donations could go to pointing out that Dianne Feinstein is not fighting for Medicare for All. She actually takes money from the health insurance companies. All the different things that Allison points out in her ads.
And it's been healthy for Feinstein to run in terms of, like, she's been a little bit more aggressive on some progressive issues. I mean, clearly, too late, but you can see it. I mean, it's interesting
to
see.
It's so transparent.
Yeah.
But the minute they get a real primary challenge, they're like, I meant higher wages.
Right.
Sure. I mean, not too high for you guys, but I meant a slightly higher. I mean, healthcare, I guess some of you should have it.
It is pretty amazing that she's not ready for single-payer healthcare. That's pretty impressive.
She's been in politics for 50 years. How long does it take to get ready for it?
Well,
we're willing to say
modern medicine. Maybe she's going to live until.
But we're willing to say things there that the standard politician is not, which is that Dianne Feinstein is lying. She's never going to be for Medicare for All. Not at 84, not at 94, not at 104. She's lying. She represents her donors, and that's the health insurance companies.
All right. Let's. What else has been? I mean. Of the stories that are floating around, what else seems to be weighing on you the most? I mean, obviously.
I mean, look, the Trump thing is massive. So I don't know if you saw this morning. I just read it right before I came on. He might have a love child. So apparently, as one of the documents that they're looking for, is the National Enquirer might have buried another story, paid off somebody $30,000. To not talk about illegitimate child that Trump had, but all the way back in the 1980s. So that kind of salacious stuff, I don't care about at all. Trump's a bad guy, cheated on his wife. No, say it ain't so. And the evangelicals couldn't care less. I've said on the show, I think that if he has, if we found out he had 3 abortions, they'd still vote for him.
Personally. Himself.
Well, if he himself had it, that would be miraculous.
Right.
But if he paid for it.
Oh, no. Of course.
Because they think God picked him. And God can't be wrong. But the reason I bring it up is the Michael Cohen thing, the Stormy Daniels thing led to the Michael Cohen documents. And now that they have Michael Cohen's documents. And you think Michael's not going to flip on him? A guy with no moral core, who basically was screwed by Donald Trump, didn't get a position in the campaign and didn't get a position in the administration. There's reports that after the win, he was wandering around unshaven for weeks inside a Trump Tower, like trying to figure out what to do with his life, right? And he got nothing from Donald Trump, nothing but grief. So that guy who's willing to do all the dirty work for Trump, who clearly has no moral center, is all of a sudden going to be like, no, I'm going to fall on my sword. Now, remember, Donald Trump cannot pardon him on state charges. So the fact that it's in New York
important. It's with the the Southern District of New York, U.S. Attorney. I mean, those are all feds.
It is.
They could theoretically hand it over to...
But you know who the Attorney General of New York is.
Right,
Eric Schneiderman.
Right.
So, who just busted Trump on $25 million for Trump University. Schneiderman can't wait.
Right. The handoff would be... He'd be very excited about that.
That's right.
So,
Syria is another huge topic. So what, I got to know a little mini debate slash fight with Ali Velshi, of all people, yesterday on Twitter. So I said that here we are again, you know, cable news without demanding any evidence. Everyone screaming at the same time, bomb, bomb, bomb. And you don't want to be like Obama. You don't want to be weak, Donald Trump. If you're a real man, you'd bomb.
Right.
Andrea Mitchell, one of the big cheerleaders for it. So it's not just conservative politicians,
no,
not just neocons.
Not.
And so he took offense to that and saying, no, this is not like the Iraq War. This is more like the Holocaust. No. Okay.
What?
And so I asked him, so Myanmar, look, you're a good guy. I'm sure you probably covered it a couple of times. But are you covering it with the same fervor that you are with Syria? Is anyone on MSNBC calling for the bombing of Myanmar to protect the Rohingya Muslims, which are now, like the UN is calling a genocide and ethnic cleansing, etc.? No. So
no.
Please stop the pretense that you care about the civilians.
Well, and by all accounts, I mean, here's what it's strange. And by all accounts, we're talking about, I don't want to diminish, obviously, like 400, 500 or 75 or 50. I mean, there have been hundreds of thousands of people who have been killed in this war. It's a little bit late to say we've got to stop the killing. We're actually closer to the end because Assad, sadly, I think, probably, is begun to maintain control. It's one thing to sort of say we're going to protect the Kurds, let's say, but there's nothing like there. Even if we were to accept the premise of this is like the Holocaust, I could say to you, okay, well then what we should do is we should bomb the railway cars. And we should continue on with the war effort. Like, what is the end game? If this is the Holocaust, okay, what's the plan?
Okay.
Like, are we going in with ground forces? We're going to put in 300,000 troops? Is that what the plan is?
And are we going to fire on Russian MiGs?
I mean, like, what's the plan? You know, this is one of the things that I feel like people are making a mistake about in arguing against U.S. involvement. I don't know if there was a barrel of chlorine that was dropped on 500 people. I think the U.N. certainly has found fairly significant evidence that Assad has used chemical weapons on his Syrian people. The Russians have kept investigators out. That question seems sort of like a third order question as to what we should do.
Yeah.
Like, the standard for our involvement should be, what is the plan? Like, nobody's even articulated what this looks like in success, right? Never mind the contemplating failure. Nobody's even, like, what is this going to look like in success? At least with Iraq, you had people who were out there pretending that they're going to come to us with flowers and it's going to be a burgeoning democracy. You know, they can't say that now because, of course, everybody realized, like, oh, that's just a bald-faced lie. Nobody's articulated what success looks like.
Yeah, well, there was in that moment in the Iraq War, that great slide presentation, which is, of course, in reality, a horrific slide presentation. It was 1, 2, 3, 4, and it was the generals. They're like, okay, now we're going to get, this is how we enter Iraq, this is how we get to Baghdad, this is how we take Baghdad. And number four was, we've taken Baghdad, what do we do? And it had three letters on it, TBD.
Yes.
Okay, to be determined, and they still haven't determined it.
No.
So for Syria, the whole thing is TBD. Drop bombs, and then TBD.
Right.
Right.
There's a black box.
Right.
You drop bombs, then we go through this black box. Good things.
Where are the good things in Syria?
The good things.
Syria?
That's right. Good things.
Is al-Nusra connected to al-Qaeda taking over Iraq? I mean, is Syria the good thing? Is the Russians taking over Syria a good thing? Is the Russians and us getting into a conflict in Syria a good thing? There are no good things in Syria.
No.
There are no good things, no. Right? So it's not to give up on that.
And it's unclear. Well, not unclear to me. The least bad option is to disengage, like, is to not attack.
Absolutely.
Syria.
So, Sam, look, I was much more of an interventionist when I was younger. I mean, all the way stretches, it's like this huge evolution all the way back to when I was a liberal Republican, but I believed in the Persian Gulf War, and then I was massively against the Iraq Gulf War. But, you know, in Libya, again, I flirted with, like, I mean, to get out Gaddafi would be amazing, and we're just bombing, and it's not ground troops. I'm now of the opinion that our interventions almost always create a gigantic mess. They're almost always counterproductive. And we got to get out. We're not doing good. We're doing harm.
The original mandate from the UN on Libya, which I was supportive of, was simply to protect the people of Benghazi, where the UN had determined there was an imminent threat of genocide. The mandate was well overshot and became regime change.
But it always does, right?
Well, I guess so. It certainly...
And by the way, I was on your side.
It certainly made it impossible to protect civilians again in that situation, because the various parties involved in the UN are like, I guess this means every time you do this, you're going to overshoot the mandate. And there seems to be at least some evidence that supports the theory that Sarkozy was so interested, because France was obviously was the big driver of regime change in Libya.
Yes.
That could have been fueled by Sarkozy's concern that there was evidence that he had been received a lot of campaign funds from.
Well, that's part of it. And Sam, I was in favor of protecting the people of Benghazi. I was in favor of the bombing campaign. Okay, so, and sometimes people say, oh, you know, you made a mistake there. And I think that it's fair to say, because in the middle of it, even as we were doing it, what you began to see was a coalition of the people who wanted to intervene were the ones who had no contracts in Libya. Their companies, the French companies, had no contracts, etc. The people who did not want to intervene already had major national companies, right, that had contracts with Gaddafi's regime. So then it became a little petri dish of, okay, this is what corruption looks like. And us progressives, even at this late date, even as jaded as you and I are, and we lived through the Bush years, now the Trump years and the Iraq War and all that stuff, and we fought the neocons and we did all that, even still, we're still a little naive. Like, yeah, is it about the money? Of course, it's always
right.
About the money.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
So why are we not talking nonstop about bombing Myanmar? Because there's no money in it. There's
right.
No money in it. So in Syria, there's money at stake. And here we are pushing for war on the same exact script. Remember, they said Saddam gassed his own people. And here we are, the sequel. Assad gassed his own people. Did we have evidence on Saddam?
Saddam did gas the Kurds, but it was certainly with our blessing. you know, the Donald Rumsfeld's over there shaking his hands right afterwards. It was not the issue for us at the time.
Yeah, that was over a decade ago, and he had our blessing. So that's a total nonsense excuse. And then they said, trust us, we have evidence of weapons of mass destruction. Now they say, trust us, we have evidence that it was Assad who did it. Actually, they can't even say that. Mattis says we don't have evidence.
Right. No, it's not been established.
Why would Assad, in the middle of almost winning and wrapping it up,
agitate everyone by doing chemical attacks? There are theories that I think that explain it. I mean, following that chemical attack, the Army of Islam left the next day, literally with thousands, and they closed the deal. And that was, you know... You drop one barrel of chlorine, and that is a deal closer. But again, that to me is a third order question, because one, you don't want to get into an argument about is Assad a good guy or a bad guy. Two, you don't want to get into an argument about something that you and I sitting here will never definitively be able to answer. The argument is, if you're going to intervene, like, to what end? Like, what is, you need to make the case, not that inaction is wrong, but that your action is going to lead to a certain positive outcome. And there isn't one. No one's made that case,
so
this because they can't.
A great example is North Korea. So is Kim Jong-un and the people who lead North Korea terrible, terrible people? No, that's not in dispute. I mean, you want to talk about Holocaust, they have concentration camps. They and how they treat their own people is worse than anywhere on the planet. Does that mean, I desperately want them to, those people to be liberated. I want Kim Jong-un gone, et cetera, et cetera. Does that mean I think war is the right answer? Are you kidding me? We'd have a million dead South Koreans in the first 5 minutes. No, war is not the right answer. Just because somebody's a bad guy doesn't mean that the solution is war.
Exactly. All right. Well, Cenk, thanks so much for coming by.
No problem.
Leave anything
Thank
on
you.
The table? I mean, yes, right? Like half of yesterday's news, probably.
That's right, because the news is so overwhelming. It's a tsunami of news.
How are you dealing with that? I mean, just like sort of, let's get a little meta for a moment. Like,
So we keep having... So our show has a lot of graphics and video, and so it actually takes a while to produce, and it's driving us crazy. We produce the show, and then new massive news comes out. We got to reproduce it. Now we're reproducing while we're live. So on an average day, there'll be like 1.5 breaking news stories, and not like breaking, the Assistant Secretary of Agriculture is resigning. No, like... Oh, my God, Donald Trump's personal lawyer's office have been raided.
Right.
Like, what? Right. He has fired the Secretary of State with a tweet. What? Right. So that's our day. It's just like constant incoming. In fact, we got a new show coming out soon with John Iadarola. It's called Damage Report because it's in the morning. You wake up and you're like, damage
what
report.
Did I mean? Right, exactly. Right. That's funny. Well, I mean, that's the reason why people complain about our lack of graphics. That's why we don't do the graphics, so that we're light on our feet and we can move.
That's right. Well, you're killing it, Sam.
No. Well, yeah. Thank you. That's
yes.
That's very nice.
March, I mean, look, you're killing it overall, but I just saw the March numbers. They were gangbusters.
Oh, well, thank
you. Guys are on fire.
All right. Cenk Uygur. Really
All right,
appreciate
Sam,
it.
Sam, thank you so much. Everybody, AllisonHartson.com, okay?
Check it
Let's
out.
Go get them.
All right, folks.
Thank you, Cenk. Thank you, Cenk.
Typical.
What's typical?
That you can't share in Cenk's same level of enthusiasm. It's just a funny temperamental difference. I like it. It's a good. You guys should do a lot more. I could see actually like an odd couple scenario with you and Cenk.
I see what you're
Some
saying.
Type of like
so he was very excited. You guys,
like, you guys are gangbusters.
I'm like, oh
okay.
That.
Well, it's been modestly nice. Thank you.
I did pretty well at the tables last night, folks. That's why I'm so excited. I am up over $150.
Wow.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
Quit while you're
tune
ahead.
In tomorrow. Yeah,
when you're negative 300,
right? Exactly.
Right. That's actually right, is well, that usually how it goes
with me?
Yeah.
I'm up like not since back in the day have I been up like this.
Nice.
All
right. Well,
so
hold it, buddy.
I think people can tell I'm living large. Here, so
is that a mimosa someone abandoned on the table in front of the camera?
It was just an orange juice. I think
that out of the way. It looks so sad and lonely
you,
and warm.
I like how you just moved it out of the way just so we could see more wires.
There you go. I'll give you a better view
it's
of this.
Still in the shot, but now you can see the wires.
That's the money shot right there. Mm-hmm.
All
right,
well. Okay, let's just
oh,
do a
oh real quick,
more
Sam. Do you have the Ronald Reagan email?
Oh right, yes.
Because that's Forgive important, me. And it is on the blog post.
So Ronald Reagan has emailed us, and I think I've mentioned Northwest Immigrants Rights Project.
Yep.
Before, in fact. We donated a little money to them back in 2017. But here is part of an email from the one of the directors. There is the DOJ is halting what is known as the legal orientation program for detainees. As you know, and we've talked about this, the Trump administration and ICE is arresting more and more immigrants. And there is no capacity to deport these people. And so more and more people are being detained. The Supreme Court, I think, recently said that this sort of indefinite detention is legal for at least some of these people. The DOJ is eliminating all of this legal orientation program funding. In other words, detainees get in there and there's no funding to provide them with any knowledge of their legal rights. The way that this funding gets dispersed is it is given to organizations like the Northwest Immigration Rights Project, which is basically a consortium of lawyers. It's basically like a law firm for detainees. A lot of their funding comes from the federal government. It's not unlike, legal defense in criminal cases. They are looking to lose now funding for over 4 full-time positions that provide presentations and screenings to detained persons up in the Northwest Detention Center. They provide services to somewhere between 3,000 and 4,000 individuals each year. We've set up a link to this organization. If you are and if you're looking to make an actual demonstrable difference in the lives of people who have been perhaps most singularly targeted under the Trump administration, you couldn't do much better than supporting this group, the Northwest Immigration Rights Project. Now, there may be other organizations like this around the country, but I'm sure there are. This one is one that's near and dear, and that comes to us from Ronald Reagan. So check that out. Now let's just do one more. Should we do this Hannity sort of somewhat meltdown?
Sure.
We should start with the ABC teaser that he's responding to.
All right, so James Comey, and I gotta say, I'm a little bit nauseated by the reformation of James Comey. Aside from his history in the DOJ, people should not forget that it was James Comey breaking one of the most basic tenets of public corruption law enforcement in releasing that information about Hillary Clinton and Anthony Weiner's computer. When he did that, he was breaking all code of conduct that he was supposed to be operating under. I have a friend who literally sat in an auditorium as he was going into the U.S. Attorney's program, and James Comey literally said, You do not publicly talk about charges in the run-up to an election because our elections are sacrosanct. And he specifically did that when it came to Hillary Clinton. So if there's anybody out there who, and again, there are literally a dozen reasons why Hillary Clinton lost the election, but James Comey is certainly one of them. And so this... The deifying of James Comey is a little bit nauseating to me, but here is ABC's teaser trailer for George Stephanopoulos sitting down with James Comey.
How strange is it for you to sit here and compare the president to a mob boss?
This Sunday night on ABC.
Are there things that you know but haven't said that could damage President Trump?
James Comey.
And to those who say you should have brought Hillary Clinton before a grand jury?
The exclusive interview everyone will be talking about.
Was President Trump obstructing justice? Should Donald Trump be impeached?
Stephanopoulos, Comey. This Sunday night at a special time, 10, 9 Central on ABC.
I hate James Comey so much. I can make a MAGA chud when it comes to James Comey.
I have to say, I hope they're both naked during that interview. That's the only way that I would tune in for that.
I don't.
Now, here's the thing. I probably agree with Comey's assessment on all of these things to a certain extent, because this is low-hanging fruit. Is Donald Trump a thug? Yeah, of course. Here's Sean Hannity having a total meltdown over that segment.
So, Mr. Comey, you're really going to compare the sitting president of the United States to a mob boss so you can make money? People that are tied to murder, drugs, money laundering, extortion, prostitution, loan sharking, and all sorts of other racketeering crimes.
To be fair, I think Trump is probably only engaged in like 3/4 of those things in that list.
Right. And I just also should add that I think, you know, James Comey built a significant part of his career of like luring like mentally limited Muslim teenagers into fake terrorism plots. So they probably share some commonalities with Donald Trump in terms of their intellectual capabilities. So, I mean, he would know.
Continue.
People that are tied to murder, drugs, money laundering, extortion, prostitution, loan sharking, and all sorts of other racketeering crimes. Now, why you do this? Just to make yourself look good? Do you really need the extra money? Just to become rich and famous? Just to make your point that you don't like Donald Trump? Now, I guess since Comey, if he's going to use this sweeping analogy, I've decided tonight we're going to use the Comey standard, I call it, and make some comparisons of our own.
Pause it for one second. Hold on. To hear Sean Hannity go, like, why are you doing this? Just to make money? How much money do you need? Are you kidding me? Are you kidding me?
Throw around reckless accusations for money? That's disgusting.
Yes. Yeah, so how could you stoop so low? How much money do you need? Of all the things to whine about with James Comey, the idea of Sean Hannity talking about, like, how greedy can you be?
Hey, Sam, I have a question. On that list, I counted one thing that I think Trump is maybe not directly involved with, or maybe two, and that was loan sharking. I don't think that's his business. And maybe not murder. Everything else I would think would be totally obvious.
I'm not convinced about the loan sharking. I have a feeling he probably subsidized something.
If we're including subsidies, which is a really strict standard, then of course. By that standard, murder too, then.
I think the narco trafficking, I think, wasn't that in there?
No, because he helped. No, there's a story about a Panama Trump hotel that was used for Colombian traffickers.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay. All right, I stand corrected.
Just to make your point that you don't like Donald Trump. Now, I guess since Comey, if he's going to use this sweeping analogy, I've decided tonight we're going to use the Comey standard, I call it, and make some comparisons of our own.
So
now, if Comey thinks Trump is a mob boss, if he is in his eyes, well, let's talk about a family responsible for actual crime. We'll call it that. Head of the notorious political cabal, of course, Bill and Hillary Clinton, the Clinton crime family. Bill Clinton, as we've shown you many times, have been accused of severe sexual misconduct, harassment, even rape by Juanita Broderick. We know he lied under oath, and we know he paid Paula Jones. We know he was impeached. And meanwhile, Hillary Clinton, well, we know she committed crime. She should have been charged if we have equal justice under the law. So
that's it.
Don't forget the pizza parlor.
It's amazing, right? Because that is literally like the Donald Trump script, right? I mean, didn't Trump? Isn't that what Trump said on the day that that Cohen's office was raided?
Yeah,
like he was sitting there with the generals talking about Syria, and he launched into an unprompted. Talking about Cohen's offices being and could not get through that statement without saying Hillary Clinton is the one who should be arrested.
I'm kind of impressed that they don't mention Obama as much.
It's not mutually exclusive.
It is
like
pretty
amazing.
Should,
they could both. They could all deserve to be arrested.
It's true. It's
maybe like not a defense for one or the other, you know?
No, well, that's the Clinton defense.
Juanita Broderick was wearing a short skirt. It's a lie. Totally unfair. It's locker room talk.
They did it too. Oh, so you both belong in jail.
All right. Should we take one phone call before we wrap up?
Yeah, let's take one call. You're calling. I'll try that 703 again. Yeah, but it's not. Oh, there it is. 703. Are you there?
No. Hang up on that.
707.
Oh.
707. Sorry. Go ahead. Got it.
Hi. Hi. Yeah. So this is Logan. I'm calling from Sonoma. So I've dealt a lot with people dealing with the Kevin DeLeon and Feinstein thing, and I really don't know how to break through on that. But that's an issue that is kind of pervasive, even with people that are really, really active politically and really trying to get out there and phone bank and all that kind of stuff. They still kind of have that sticking point of keeping establishment Democrats is the way to go. So I actually called to talk about something else. I'd really love it if you could bring on someone who could talk about community land trusts or how small local communities have been able to fight real estate speculation. It's a problem that really happens a lot in, especially in Sonoma. It's wine country here, so you get a lot of retirees or people purchasing second homes, and it's driven housing prices to the point where in a small community where basically every job is service industry based or teachers or whatever, where people are making, you know, $60,000, maybe broaching $75,000 a year, a two-bedroom home is running you upwards of $500,000-$600,000. And you've got even townhomes and apartment buildings that are going for, you know, $1 million+. And so it's a problem for the local community to try to find funding to support this. Private companies can't really be relied on to take care of the problem just because, obviously, land values are so high, they're not going to be able to recoup that kind of stuff. So, yeah, anyway, it would be a great guest to have.
Yeah, all right. So, yeah, send us an email about that. That is, but and we'll look into it and see. Interesting topic.
Very
all right,
cool.
Well,
thank you.
All right, folks. We got to wrap up on this end. We'll be back tomorrow. We've got I'm going to try and sit down with Tom Hartman, who's out here. He's obviously he's doing his show at this time, so it's a little bit tricky. And
shilling for my wife.
She's Tom Hartman.
Tom Hartman's a shill. Long shilling Mehdi Hasan and everyone else.
All right. Well.
Yeah, all right.
I don't know what that's in reference to.
I just wanted to do the impression.
Oh, all right. All right.
Anybody else you wanted to tease?
We'll be talking to, there's some new stuff happening on the terrorism banking front. And I think we'll have some others. But we will check it out tomorrow.
Go get those
folks,
tables.
We will see you tomorrow.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb, but finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know gonna kick in, and my pilot light shining bright. I guess somewhere the choice was made for the option where you don't get paid, for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I guess somehow I lost my drive.